Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Absolutely stoked. And listen, I'm bringing back a phrase from 10 years ago for the card that we have coming up this weekend. Headlined by Bantamweights Corey Sandhagen taking on the returning TJ Dillashaw. As always, one half of your host, Noah Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen FNP. See, I can't even get it out. I'm so excited. On the respective socials, Matt, we have a great card coming up this weekend. There's so many big time fights in the lower weight classes. And hey, even if you like it, up at heavyweight, the high altitude, you have Shamil Abdurakhimov making his return, taking on Chris Daukaus. But overall, what a great card we have coming up this weekend.
Your excitement is more than justified for this card, because let's just even go back to this past weekend's main event. Islam Makhachev versus Thiago Moises. That's a good fight, don't get me wrong. But you know what fight's far more exciting? Corey Sandhagen versus TJ Dillashaw. And that's no disrespect to either guy in what was last night's main event, but when you have the former champion making his long-awaited return off of his rightful suspension, let's not get anything twisted, fighting one of the most exciting guys in this division in Corey Sandhagen, I know I am so thrilled for this card. And there's a ton of other great fights going up and down the card. You mentioned Abdurakhimov versus Chris Daukaus. I know I'm excited for Ian Heinisch fighting Nasruddin Imavov. Adrian Yanez, Randy Coast is a really big fight. Like, there's a lot of really great fights in this card, top to bottom.
So from last week, there are a few salty customers in the comments section. They said, hey, you're crazy for not picking Alain Badeau. So I threw it out there in the comments section. If Badeau wins, I'll do a shot at Dustin Poirier's hot sauce. And then there was somebody else that said, Conejo Mad is going to absolutely blow the doors off Amanda Lemos. And hey, was the stoppage a little controversial? Maybe, but Lemos blew the doors off Conejo. So there's the Dustin Poirier's hot sauce. I'll trickle a little bit.
But that's only because it tastes good.
Squirt a little bit. That was real. But Matt, there's a reason why I'm fine with squirting that, because we have a battle of the junk food on this card. What can you tell us about it?
So we do have Adrian Yanez, the Dr. Pepper. I don't know if he's officially sponsored yet, but hopefully we can get something going. And Randy loves his Reese's Pieces, which is something I can relate to. And that's the good thing. It's like, that's kind of the people's main event. It's not often that you have two unranked fighters that there's this much excitement around them fighting. And it's not like evil bad blood, you know what I mean? Like, you don't have to be like Conor McGregor going dark on Dustin Poirier to get people excited for a fight. Randy Costa and Adrian Yanez are just excited that they both like junk food and they're both really good bantamweights, and I know I'm thrilled for that fight.
Well, we love the fight, so without giving it away, but giving it away, let's flip it on over to our Fight of the Night screen. It's always presented by Manscaped. You can check them out, manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to save 20% off and get free shipping. So, without further ado, throw it on over to that Fight of the Night screen. And when we're talking Adrian Yanez and Randy Costa, I mean, you look at this fight. One guy, 13-3. You look at his losses, I mean, against names that you know and recognize. Miles Johns, who was supposed to be on last weekend's card. Unfortunate that his fight with Anderson Dos Santos fell out. But losing a split decision like that, it's no worries whatsoever. And so far in the UFC, Adrian Yanez has looked amazing. Even his win on Contender Series over Brady Huang. Then he picks up a huge win over Victor Rodriguez. I had said maybe the worst fighter in the UFC.
He made him look like it.
Gustavo Lopez, definitely not one of the worst fighters in the UFC. Big win for Adrian Yanez there. And it lasted quite a while into the third round. Randy Costa, still a buzzsaw. His only loss in his career. Call up against Brandon Davis. So for Randy Costa, for Adrian Yanez, perfect matchmaking here. I was a little down on Costa coming into his last fight. But man, this guy has looked amazing. And listen, go Reese's Pieces. Reese's Pieces for life.
Oh, yeah. Two guys, they both could not have picked better snack foods. If I got a, like, tier list pop, Dr. Pepper's near the top. And for snacks,
my number one.
Reese's are near the top, too. So I agree with both guys' snack choices. Here's the thing. When guys like Teddy Atlas are tweeting about your boxing in MMA, and you're an unranked fighter who not many people know about, it means that you're doing something right. And the fact that Adrian Yanez is a fighter like that, who seems to get more acclaim than he probably should for where he's at in his career, tells you all you need to know. And for Randy Costa, just go back to the Brandon Davis UFC debut. He fought Brandon Davis on like a day's notice, and that fight was absolutely insane for as long as it lasted. I understand he lost, but that was one of those rare fights where I do feel like he gained stock, even though he did lose that fight, because it was absolutely wild for as long as it lasted. And for Costa, yeah, his last two wins might not be over the best level of competition, but it matters how you win your fights, and he's going out there absolutely beating the brakes off his last two. I think this fight's going to deliver.
Can't wait for it. Well, it's going to be tough to pick another selection, but let's throw it to our second choice for fight of the night. And for our second choice for possible fight of the night, listen, it was between three bantamweight fights. You had Costa and Yanez, you have Phillips taking on Paiva, and the main event's a great fight, too. Exactly. But you want to be a hipster, and you want to make the hipsters pick. Kyler Phillips, so far in his young UFC career, he had that fight against James Gray over on Contender Series. He ends up getting the win. He beats Gabriel Silva, who was always in the shadow of his brother, you know, forever prospect. Matt, who is it?
Claudio.
No, Claudio Silva.
Oh, no, Eric Silva's his brother.
Eric
Goodness.
Silva, forever prospect. And that's a fight of the night. And then he's able to get the win over Cameron Els, where he gets a performance bonus. His last time out, he had a great fight. It was definitely in the running for fight of the night against Song Yadong. Very close fight, unanimous decision nonetheless. Kyler Phillips looked amazing. For Holly and Paiva, couldn't make weight his last time out. Weighed in at 129 pounds. Ends up, his fight got scrapped. His last win was against Zhalgash Shumagulov a year ago. But I love this fight stylistically.
I think this fight's going to be a really fun one. I know Kyler Phillips has a lot of hype going into this fight because a lot of people were excited after that Song Yadong fight, myself included. And I don't really care how you judge that fight. It really showed that both guys deserve to have a number next to their name in the bantamweight division. And for Holly and Paiva, this is a really big opportunity for him. You mentioned the weight miss. If you're able to go in there and beat a guy like Kyler Phillips, who is not only a very entertaining prospect, but a prospect who seems to have a very high ceiling too, then that really just transfers all the hype over to Holly and Paiva. And in a division like bantamweight, only one or two wins can really get you up against like a legend in the division, even like a Jose Aldo. So that just kind of tells you this fight's exciting, but it's who these guys could be fighting next, which makes it even more exciting.
Crazy to see Kyler Phillips with 10 pro fights, and he's older than Holly and Paiva, coming in with 23. So I can't wait for this one. Should be a striker's paradise for what it's worth, but we'll see who can add the wrinkles of their game to this one. Matt, you got to check it out. Manscaped.com, they're presenting this fight in the night screen. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. Absolutely loaded card to come. So overall, it is a stacked card coming up, and you're not going to want to miss any of those individual videos. If anything changes this week, I will be away. However, we'll update as needed. And of course, we have had some fights that were shuffled around. Trevin Jones was originally supposed to take on Tony Kelly. Aaron Phillips was supposed to fight Cameron Els. Then Jones is going to fight Phillips, and now that fight's off. And Trevin Jones is going to end up fighting Ronnie Lawrence next week. Hopefully, fingers crossed. Jones just wants a fight. Asun Sal was supposed to take on Kyler Phillips originally. Sajara Eubanks was supposed to take on Priscilla Cachoeira, who's now taking on Elise Reed in her UFC debut. So a lot of moving pieces, Matt. But overall, a very interesting card.
The good news is that we're still really excited for this card. And do you want to know what other cards are really excited for right now, too?
15-minute card breaks. Our second channel, Matt. Great setup. We opened some Panini Prism Blaster boxes here on this channel with Fight Night Picks. It got us so incensed that we decided to start another channel. It's 15-minute card breaks. It's on the YouTube. So we got one video where we opened two blaster boxes of Panini Prism. We've got a video where we opened the Pete Rose, Charlie Hustle. You're guaranteed an autograph. You're going to like to see the autograph that we ended up with. Our latest video, we opened some Donruss 2020-2021 cards. Now, Matt, there were four packs in this box, 10 cards per pack. You were guaranteed 8 exclusive parallels. One of those parallels was absolutely insane. Good thing I have those in protective coverings. But overall, it's a lot of fun. We also opened a full-sized autograph mystery box of a helmet. That one's pretty cool from Hit Parade. So check it out. 15-minute card breaks. All sorts of great stuff over there. If you like to just hear us talk, subscribe. And then just let it play throughout the day. If the cats, the dogs are going to listen to it. Maybe you're going on a big trip. You download an episode somehow. I don't know. Get crazy with it. But at 15-minute card breaks on Instagram, TikTok, as well as Twitter. And you can find us there on YouTube as well. I'm really excited for it. There's going to be content trickling out throughout the coming weeks. We got a lot of stuff banked. So if you like that kind of stuff, find us there. And if you don't, well, there's MMA. So without further ado, keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. What feels like a make-or-break fight coming up this weekend at women's strawweight, and you heard that right. We have the Canadian transplant from Romania, Diana Belbitia, the Warrior Princess. She's taking on Fusion XL's Hannah Goldie. Her nickname's 24K. Can she make it work?
Is she 48% of Dane Ige?
Maybe. I don't know.
That's the first thing that came to my mind.
Let's see what happens. But for Hannah Goldie, 5-1 the overall record. If you've seen her fight, you know how good her striking is. In and out, a lot of volume, a little bit of power there to boot. Now, the thing that you might not like if you do look at Goldie's overall body of work, she debuted against Jillian Robertson back in 2016 and beat her. That's great. Then she took on Vanessa Grimes. She wins that fight. Lisa Blaine, Shannon Gary, and then Kaylee Robbins on Contender Series. And then had a very short layoff and took on Miranda Granger. Lost that fight. She's been out for almost 2 years. Now, it's not for lack of trying. She was booked against Loma Lookbanmi earlier on this year. Goldie withdrew. She was supposed to take on Jessica Penne, but she tested positive for COVID. And then she withdrew from their second booking a little over a month after that. So hopefully Hannah Goldie's recovered well. And like I said, she's taking on the transplanted Romanian to Canada, who now trains out of Ontario's Stony Creek, in Diana Balbizia. Billed as a striker. Former K-1 champ over in Europe. She was a multinational champion over there. Transitioned to mixed martial arts at the young age of 18. Maybe not the strongest level of competition on the way up. She had a little bit of a two-fight losing streak in 2015. But that's a long ways behind her. She lost to Ariane Lipsky on the regional scene. She also lost to Ione Razafirzin, a name that we see a lot popping up on European fighters' records. Went on a 4-fight win streak, ended up in the UFC, lost to Molly McCann, pretty well got dominated in that fight, lost to Liana Jojua, and she looked like she was lost in that fight.
She really did. She didn't look good at all. And I'm honestly going to throw myself under the bus before I say anything else about this video, because I openly said that Liana Jojua is one of the worst grapplers I've ever seen in the UFC. And that was true up until that point. And that was kind of why her submission loss to Jojua was so surprising. I'm not here to tell you that Diana Belbeach is some phenom on the mat or anything, but I definitely did not think that she was going to get out-grappled so soundly by Jojua. And we had seen Jojua understandably up a weight class, but still, we saw her struggle, grappling against the Morris's of the world, who, you know, she's a good fighter, but she's not a great fighter. And here, I'm going to quote Ryan Russillo when he talked about Kawhi Leonard and his free agency when I think about this fight. If anybody tells you they have a good idea about this fight, then don't listen to them when they break down fights, because there's just such a limited sample size about both these fighters against top levels of competition. Belbicia has not really shown that she's able to go out there and really win rounds off of great fighters, even good fighters. Go back through a record. A lot of the wins are to the 0-0s of the world, or the 1-0s, the 0-1s. Ariane Lipsky is one of the few good fighters on her resume, and look how that fight ended. She did lose that fight by armbar. It's really weird that this fight is even on this card, for being completely honest, and I don't like saying that people aren't UFC caliber. It's just when these two fighters haven't really given any reason as to why they should be on this card, it's really surprising. I know we both said that Hannah Goldie was almost like a more improved version of Miranda Granger going into that fight, but leaving that fight, I definitely didn't have that opinion, and it was really weird because a lot of the strengths that we both assumed Goldie would have leading up to that fight, they weren't really strengths. She's undersized for this division. I don't really like her in and out movement as much as I thought I would. And at the end of the day, I just don't really know what she's going to be able to do against a lot of these fighters to prove that she's better in a 15-minute contest.
Now, that's the trouble. So you got to pump the brakes a little bit, and we have to process all of this. Goldie went up to 125 to take on Granger, who is a 25er. So that's why that one was really weird. Granger had a big size advantage. The same can be said. Jojo moved down from 35 to 25 and ends up beating Diana Belbizia.
She is a 25er, though.
Belbizia is a 25er who's now moving down to strawweight to take this fight against Goldie. So I'm eager to see both of these two on the scales. Obviously, if you've seen anything from Hannah Goldie, it's the fact that she's bodied up. And listen, I don't need James Lynch to tell you about her OnlyFans. It's out there, too. It's a really tricky fight when you're trying to cap it. So, it's a big use of CYA on our parts, but listen, not every time you can get Malcolm Gordon to beat Francisco Figueiredo and say, hey, you gotta watch out for this one, and then people are telling you that you're a fucking idiot on Twitter. So, pump the brakes there a little bit, but when we have a look at the odds for this one, that's what scares me as well. Goldie opened to minus 195, she's now minus 182, a favorite. And for Diana Belbizia, the underdog, she opened to plus 160, she's at a plus 148. Like I said, she has a striking background, she's looked good in the clinch in some of her regional scene fights. I'm eager to see what kind of a game plan she implements in this one, because it felt like she was too confident in the clinch in her last time out, And it cost her.
It's just wild that you have to say, oh, she looked good in the clinch and regional fights for us to say, oh, this could be a strength of hers coming into the UFC. And she hasn't shown anything in her last two fights. Molly McCann is a decent fighter, but not a great fighter in this weight division, or in this weight class, even at 125. Like, we kind of know where her limitations are skill-wise, and she beat the brakes off Belbicha. Like, that wasn't a very competitive fight at all. And again, the fact that Jojua, who is an all-right grappler in top position, was just able to run through Belbicha, it just doesn't give me a lot of confidence with her moving forward. And it's not like Hannah Goldie's shown me a lot either, but I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm more confident with the limited skills of Hannah Goldie than I am with the skills of Belbicha at this point in time.
Belbicha coming in with a big reach advantage and a decent little advantage as well in terms of the height. If we have a look over on Tapology for the total votes, 507 so far, 78% with Goldie, 88% by decision. For the 22% that have Belbicha, 73% by decision. I think if you like the over 2.5 here, the fight to go the distance, it's not just those Tapology votes, but if you look at it for Hannah Goldie over her career, she has one finish win. For Diana Belbicha, she has only 3 decisions, but so far in the UFC, 1 decision against Molly McCann, and then the quick loss to Liana Jojua, the forever grappler. Hannah Goldie, not so much a grappler, more of a death by 1,000 cuts. So for me, I like the decision pick, but if my back was against the wall and Matt likes me to make a pick, I'm going to go with Hannah Goldie, but again, maybe not the most confident. I think the volume's going to play out in her favor in this fight. For Diana Belbicha, going to have to close the distance, which is going to sound strange because she is the bigger, longer fighter. But it's the side-to-side movement of Hannah Goldie, always working that footwork in her fights that you like to see. So for those reasons, I'm going with Goldie. But if you can make a good argument for Diana Belbicha, you let us know down below in the comments section.
I can't disagree with anything you said on this fight. Again, Belbicha is going to have her opportunities. And if she can get this fight to the clinch consistently, then she might just be able to win minutes, which would then equal winning rounds. But other than that, I do think Hannah Goldie is going to be the one, at least in the middle of the cage. I do like her footwork slightly more than Belbicha. And I do think she can at least avoid some of the strikes of Diana on the feet and at least retaliate with her own. So ever so slightly gonna pick Hannah Goldie, but I think we've thrown up enough like red tape on this pick that I wouldn't put any money on this fight.
Both of us going with 24K Hannah Goldie to get the win. You're not gonna want to miss the rest of the predictions for this card, Matt. Listen, we've got the junk food special. It's Reese's Pieces versus Dr. Pepper
in the air.
People don't come here for the singing.
I tried.
But you can come for 15-minute card breaks. It's also our channel. You can find a link to that below in the description. You're not going to want to miss any of the content for this week. So as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Somebody at home will be watching this one and saying, boys, we have quite the fight coming tonight. Matt, Sajara Eubanks moving back down to flyweight. Yikes. And she's going to be taking on Elise Reed. Matt, Elise Reed, I have a great stat line for her because she's had an absolutely incredible life so far coming into the cage. This one from MMAProspects.com. She was the Cage Fury Fighting Championship strawweight champion, a U.S. Army reservist, an Iraq war veteran, a Virginia Military Institute highest ranking female graduate, third degree Taekwondo black belt, and the owner of Chief Instructor of Kickside MMA. That's absolutely insane. I've gone back through and watched a lot of different interviews from Elise Reed, and there's a lot of them out there this week. But one with JHK that he did with Sports Keita. Now, he does great work for us, and he does great work for them as well. But she has a wild military background. She teaches a lot of different courses out there, too. She mainly served in Kuwait, but also a little bit in Iraq. And if you look at the way that she fights, she does fight in a very karate-style stance. She throws a lot of front kicks up the middle, mixes in her kicks with her punches. She has decent takedown defense. I wouldn't say it's great, but she has decent takedown defense against a lot of those upper body throws that we see in some of women's MMA, and good enough defensive grappling from what we've seen so far. She's been able to reverse a lot of positions. For Elise Reed, I remember watching her first fight on the Bellator prelims way back when at Bellator 231, and I was a lot less excited for Elise Reed than I was to see Rebecca Brigman fight. And if you're a Rebecca Brigman fan, she's got a big fight coming up with the fight organization that we cover live and in person, NEF at NEF 44. She's going to be taking on Bangor's own Glory Watson. Can't wait for the fight. Watson's a hell of a fighter. You look up her amateur record, it's wild. I think I've been there for every fight. She's 0-1 pro. All that to say, Rebecca Brigman, also known as Orion Starr, Google it. Just Google it. But for Elise Reed, she picked up a TKO win there. She won by decision against Jasmine Jaws DeVicious. She beat Jillian DeCourcy that you see on Twitter every single week. And then she beat Hillary Rose at CFFC 97 just a couple of months ago. So for Elise Reed, huge call-up. Matt, so Jerry Eubanks was supposed to take on Priscilla Cachoeira at 135 pounds, who just came off a huge win in her own right. That was going to be an interesting fight for Eubanks, whose record isn't sexy whatsoever. The UFC is going to say 7-6. We're going to say 6-6. But the last time she fought at 125, she weighed 127.2 against Roxanne Modafferi back in 2018. So it's going to be a return. She's 36. What are you saying?
I don't think this fight's going to be competitive at all. I got to get that out of the way right now. And my opinion of Jara Eubanks is probably 15% lower than what the average is. But this is the problem. Elise Reed's style, and I'm going to push back on one thing you said. Her defensive grappling isn't great. She does get into a lot of bad positions. Now, she has been able to work herself out of those positions against some levels of competition. But you shouldn't be getting put into inverted triangles and then sweep from the top position. That's the problem. When I've seen you in positions like that with much lower level competition and much worse grapplers than what Jara Eubanks is going to be bringing into the UFC, it's just a really hard ask. And I know we say this a lot. When you're on short notice, when you get brought into short notice, yes, you can have like the Terrence McKinney type wins, but unless you have knockout power like that, it's going to be really, really hard to go out and have a full gas tank that someone normally would when they have a full training camp. So the fact that Elise Reed's taking this fight on short notice against a much, much larger fighter, and this is the thing about Jara Eubanks, I don't know what her weight cut's going to be. It could be good, it could be bad. I'm not going to know the answer to that question until question mark kicks. But for right now, what I can tell you is that Jara Eubanks hits way harder than Elise Reed. She doesn't have great stand-up, and she does actually leave herself open quite a bit, but she is a fighter who throws everything in her shots. If you go back to the Aspen Ladd fight, and I'll be very honest, I probably put too much stock in that fight than I should, but if you could... My whole theory is that if you're that fighter one night, then you could be that fighter again another fight. And she looked really good in that fight. I understand Aspen Ladd walked away with the win, but the fact that Jara Eubanks was able to have a fight of the night with Aspen Ladd, who at the time was considered like the contender in the division, of course, till Jermaine Duranemi beat her, I don't see this being that competitive. I really do think Elise Reed's going to have a very hard time with the physical strength of Jara Eubanks. And the fact that Reed throws so many kicks is actually going to be a detriment to her. The fact that she throws kicks is actually going to take away from her own mobility. And if you're throwing a lot of kicks, you can't really move when you're throwing kicks. And the problem, well, you can't. When one foot's in the air, the other's going to be on the ground. And with someone like Jara Eubanks, who can just do that really nasty grind style of wrestling where I'm going to hold you against the cage, I'm going to sap you of your strength, and I'm going to try to take you down, I think it's a really hard ask for Elise Reed. If she did have, like, real knockout power, one punch, one kick power, then I might believe in her. I'm just having a really hard time seeing the areas of the fight that she'll have success in.
It is really tricky, and that's an agreement, because, yeah, when you're throwing kicks like that and you have to plan, that's Eubanks' time to just drive right in. Now, can she get caught? I wouldn't say she's going to get caught with a front kick on the way in, but maybe this is a Machida in Elise Reed, the Taekwondo master. Maybe it's an Anthony Pettis. I get that. That might be the better comp. But in this one, both women training out of the same area of the world. You have Eubanks coming out of Nick Cantone MMA. Mark Henry in the corner. When I looked at the odds for this one, maybe not much of a surprise. Eubanks opened a minus 225. She's now a minus 277 favorite over on best fight odds. For Elise Reed, open a plus 190. She's plus 219 now. Over on Tapology, a surprise to us as it is to you, hey, it's pretty close. 556 total votes, 59% Eubanks, 87% by decision. For the 41% that I've read, 81% by decision. Maybe you like the over on this one. For me, I like Eubanks. And again, it might be a little bit of recency bias. It might be the fact that they had her booked against Carol Hosa and then Priscilla Cachoeira. Listen, Cachoeira in her last win against Gina Mazzani, all she had to do, outlast the early storm, pick up a huge TKO win. That's probably what she wanted to do against Eubanks. For Elise Reed, though, just fought 2 months ago. She's going to be fresh. She's moving up a weight class, so the energy systems will be there. But it's a really tough ask against Jara Eubanks, and I get it. Not all 500 fighters are created equal. Somewhere on that scale is like a random Marcos. And somewhere on that scale is Artem Lobov, who still has that clause in every single contract that he could fight Zubair Tukugov at a moment's notice at the drop of a hat. But for Jara Eubanks, I go through and I look at the losses. Kianzad got tired. Katlin Vieira was another loss. Bechkohea, Aspen Ladd, Chukagian. Big, big names. The wins, Avila, Morris, Modafferi, Lauren Murphy. Realistically, if she made weight, she probably would have beat Nico Montano. And we could be talking about the flyweight champ, but the weight was always an issue. for Sajara Eubanks.
That's the thing with Sajara Eubanks. I know Jessica Ai was a fighter who fought the majority of her career at 135, and then after the UFC did open the women's flyweight division, she then did make the weight cut down. But for Eubanks, it was kind of the opposite. She couldn't make weight. She was forced to move up because they wouldn't put her in that main event against Valentina Shevchenko at Madison Square Garden. Remember, that was the whole weird thing. Derek Lewis ended up fighting Volkov on that card. It was just weird. Or no, he fought Daniel Cormier in the main event of that card because it was all weird. But Sajara Eubanks at 125 really is a problem. Like, that is her weight class if she is able to make the weight. I understand that's a very big caveat, but people have kind of forgot how good she was down at 125. Against the bigger fighters at 135, her physical strength isn't really shining through as it does down a weight division. And I really do think that if she can make this weight comfortably, then this fight will not be much of a contest.
Elise Reed, she is an American hero, and that's not a joke coming from a Canadian. So credit to the service. But for me, I'm going with Sajara Eubanks. I think the physicality could be an issue, but I'm not throwing it on a card because that red flag of the weight, you're going to have to wait for question mark kicks. Hey, we'll see what happens later on in the week. You also have Eubanks here?
Yes, I do.
Both of us going with Nick Cantone, MMA Zone, Sajara Eubanks to get the win. You're not going to want to miss the rest of the videos. In the co-main event at 135, Macy Chasson's got a really tricky fight taking on Aspen Ladd. And in the main event, holy smokes, the return of the little snake in the grass. TJ Dillashaw is going to be taking on Corey Sandhagen, and you're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. It was really hard to narrow down our Fight of the Night selections for this weekend. In your main event, you have a wild fight coming up between Corey Sandhagen and the man himself, TJ Dillashaw. And it goes on from there. This fight is no different. We have Julio Arce taking on Mr. Highlight, Andre Yule. And for Andre Yule fans, stay tuned for more with Fight Night Picks. If you're not already subscribed, do so. It's easy. It's free. I won't charge you. You toss us a like, I'll pat myself on the back, and Matt. And listen, maybe an angel gets his wings. But in this fight, this is Julio Arce's first fight since 2016 at bantamweight. His last time out was a second consecutive loss against Brian Kelleher. He ended up losing that fight by submission. But since then, well, he's only lost two fights. Two of his last three. Hakeem Dawodu by split decision, that was back in 2019, the last time we saw him. He had a fight booked earlier this year against Timur Valiyev that he was forced to withdraw from. He had a win over Julian Arosa before that, a loss against PFL's Shaymon Moraes by split decision as well. But in the UFC, a win over Dan Ige and also win over Daniel Taymor. Is he your favorite Taymor?
Probably, I'd have to say.
Your favorite over David. But I was in the building for his win over Dan Ige, and that cemented my love for Julio Arce, my respect for Julio Arce. This is a former Ring of Combat featherweight champ. He had an absolute great run before he came into the UFC, and he's one of the lone fighters that you see in the UFC training out of Tiger Schulman's. Mike Trezano, another one. Shane Burgos, another guy as well. Two great guys to train with for a fight like this against Andre Yule, who has some of the lankiest, longest strikes that you're going to find in this division.
Andre Yule is a guy who we've been talking about his boxing for what feels like years now, and it almost felt like the UFC was starting to come around on the Andre Yule hype train. They were like, hey, you want to fight Marlon Vera? And I know I was really excited for that fight. Chito Vera, he's super exciting, never gets into a boring fight. At that time, Andre Yule had just come off the Anderson Dos Santos win, and he looked great in that fight. And that was kind of where we saw the limitation of Andre Yule's skill set, because he did look good in the early goings of that fight, but you could tell that every minute that passed, Marlon Vera was able to get closer to him, and closer to him, and closer to him. And the thing about Andre Yule is that the negative space in between him and his opponent is almost like an offensive weapon for him. The longer range that he can keep from his opponent means that he can snipe them on the way in from longer away. He is kind of similar, people aren't going to like this comp, but he is similar to Conor McGregor, to where he has that wide stance. A lot of people talk about his boxing. He's not really a traditional boxer. Same thing with McGregor. Like, McGregor fought Mayweather, and a lot of people say, oh, he's a boxer, oh, he's a boxer, he's a boxer. He's not. He's a counter-striker, and an MMA counter-striker at that. He's very good when his opponent is smaller, and when they have to rush in at him, because he's a very intelligent striker, and he can see where the openings of his opponent are. And honestly, Andre Yule has a very rudimentary form of that game, but there are some similarities there. The weird thing about Andre Yule is that up until his last fight against Chris Gutierrez, at least he was winning most of the striking exchanges in all of his fights. Like, even in the Marlon Vera fight, when they're at long range, he's beating Marlon Vera up, and he's beating him to the punch. But once they get into clinch and on the ground, Marlon Vera just beats the brakes off him, and that really is the problem with Andre Yule. When you do find a way to get on the inside of his range, he really does struggle, and he's not a guy like Brian Ortega, who figured out, okay, I'm tall and I'm good at boxing. Well, when guys get close to me, oh, I should probably learn elbows and spinning elbows, because now I'm going to make them pay for it. Andre Yule's never really found down that close range weapon. And I really do feel like he's a fighter who, if he could just figure out like a basic tie clinch and throw some knees at the middle, I really do feel like he could win some of those close fights that he has lost. But the last loss to Chris Gutierrez really did hurt the stock of Andre Yule in my mind's eye, because he not only got beat up with the leg kicks, he got beat up with the body kicks, and he even started to lose some of the boxing exchanges with Gutierrez near the end of the fight. That's the thing with Yule. He has that great style. He's a great counter striker. But every minute that ticks off the clock, his opponent gets a little bit more into the fight and a little bit more into the fight. And this is going to be interesting in this fight. And I actually want to get your opinion on this, because Julio Arce, I feel like, is a very good fighter. But the one thing that he does lack is a very, very high output. And I do feel like in this fight, he could almost get caught into that single strike for single strike with a guy like Andre Yule.
Both guys actually, through their UFC runs, are above and away the UFC average in terms of output. Now, it does go slightly in the favor of Andre Yule. It's 4.25 for Arce to 4.42 significant strikes landed per minute. But that's the thing, the strike percentage is better for Yule. There's going to be a lot of hitting air. You see that with some Tiger Schulman guys. Jimmy Rivera is a guy like that. He has to kind of break distance by throwing strikes and then collapse on his guys, which you would think Arce is actually going to have to do in this fight against Yule, another good guy to train with. However, having said all that, the striking differential is much better for Arce. 2.87 strikes absorbed per minute to 4.25 absorbed for Yule, who has a slight positive compared to a major positive for Arce. In terms of the grappling, a little negligible. I mean, listen, you're not going to see Yule shoot for takedowns, although over on his Instagram, he has been training his wrestling at the Silverback Wrestling Academy with Pedro Tavares and Ian Butler. So maybe you do like to see that. I think that's a good picture to see from the last couple of weeks. But for Julio Arce, if he's going to do anything, it's hard to take him down. We've seen that so far in his run, even on the regional scene as well. So when I look at this fight, the odds, maybe not a surprise to me. They might be a surprise because he hasn't been all that active. Again, this is his first fight since November of 2019, losing by split decision to Hakeem Dawodu, the premier Muay Thai striker, if there ever was one. I look at this line, Arce open to minus 180, he's a minus 197 right now. For Yule, open to plus 155. He's a plus 162. If we have a look at Tapology, the fan votes are as surprised as they are to you. Matt, 617 total votes, 72% RSA, 85% of the fans having to win by decision. For the 28% that have Yule, 80% by decision. This is the third fight in a row where the fans are predicting this fight ends in a decision. What are you saying here?
This is a weird fight, honestly, because I can see a world where Andre Yule is able to keep that distance. He is able to just crack left straight, left straight, left straight, and just keep on landing on Julio Arce, because I do feel like the speed advantage does lie with Andre Yule. The issue is that he doesn't have that plan B backup. He doesn't have a great takedown he can go to if he does get hurt on the feet. He doesn't check leg kicks, which is another really big issue, and we saw that hole get completely exposed in his last fight. And that's really my problem with Andre Yule. I love the plan A, but the problem is, where is the plan B? We've never really seen him be able to go to a really solid backup plan in any of these fights. And this thing about Julio Arce, he can be a little bit of a slow starter, and that could give Andre Yule a chance to crack him early on in the fight. But other than that one early opportunity from Yule to crack him when he's cold, I actually do like Arce by decision in this one.
For Arce, I think it's going to be one of those rolling tide type of fights, and that's why I like Arce in this one as well. Again, I think a guy that took that time off, it's unfortunate that we didn't get to see the fight against Valiev, and you might kind of snicker at that one because of how good Valiev is and how good of a fight he had against Jaime Barcelos.
It would have been a tough fight for Arce.
Would have been a tough fight, but he's been planning the move down to bantamweight. It's not like this was a snap judgment like, well, Sajara Eubanks and Elise Reed meeting in the middle at 125. So for those reasons, I like Julio Arce. If you really do feel strongly about Andre Yule, you let us know down below in the comments section, and you're not going to want to miss our own JHK's interview with Mr. Highlight. So check that out on the channel. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Absolute fireworks and a possible fight of the night at bantamweight. We have Adrian Yanez taking on the Zohan Randy Costa. Matt, I absolutely love this fight. You can find him on Twitter and Instagram at Matt Allen FNP. You can find me at Craig Allen FNP in the channel. Well, it's at Fight Night Picks. Matt, we have a battle of the junk food. What can you tell us about it?
Fights like this don't happen in the UFC all that often. Normally, the UFC, A, doesn't like it when fighters represent their own brands outside the UFC, but also, we don't normally get prospects of this caliber fighting each other so early on in their careers, and that's what makes this fight so exciting. And I know there's a lot of people just like us who almost call for these guys to wait. Wait until they're a little bit more progressed into their MMA careers before we match them up, but I gotta be honest, I think this fight is an absolute treat buried on the prelims, because Adrian Yanez is a guy who, it's not just us talking about him, it is pretty much everyone across the UFC is talking about Adrian Yanez. Giannis and the hype that he has right now in the UFC. He's not just compared to a small Jorge Masvidal because of his fighting style and his looks. He's getting very similar results to Masvidal, at least in the later half of Masvidal's career, because for the longest time, Masvidal was almost known as the split decision king, and then he became known for his crazy boxing. Adrian Giannis is just known for the crazy boxing and not having the close split decisions to begin with, and this fight against Randy Costa is going to be interesting because we're going to get the answer of who really is the prospect at 135. I really do think this fight's going to answer that.
It should be a great one. Now, I had the knock against Randy Costa, the fact that when he came into the UFC, he had a great record. He was getting wins that you wanted to see. 46 seconds, 11 seconds, 111, 42. But the guys he was fighting, 0-4, 0-0, 5-9, 0-1, it really scared me. He got the incredibly short notice call up back in 2019 against Brandon Davis. He lost by rear naked choke, but it was a lot of fun while it lasted. That was UFC 236, Holloway versus Poirier, number two. Dustin Poirier, interim champ? Wowee. But then after that, he beat Boston Salmon, and he threw everything and the kitchen sink at him in that fight. But it was the home for the right hand that Boston Salmon just, it almost looked like he couldn't see it coming. And every time, it just hit over and over again. The neat thing about the guy that is Randy Costa, and we really saw that in the Jurrien Newsom fight, and you can kind of touch on it a little bit more, I'll pass the torch, is the fact that his footwork's wonky, and he always leaves guys guessing. And even in the Newsom fight, you could see Newsom's hands were down, almost as if to block the body kick.
It was a very similar knockout to the one that Rose Namajunas had over Weili Zhang not that long ago, because it feels like a lot of the time when someone gets knocked out in under a minute, we like to say, oh, it was just a flash KO, it was a fluke. But you can actually set up a knockout in a very short amount of time, and that was more what we saw in that Jurrien Newsom fight. The footwork that Randy Costa shows to his opponent is very interesting. It is very Lyoto Machida-esque, to where he likes to feint his kicks a lot with kind of moving his hips. You'll see that a lot in the Jurrien Newsom fight, where he's kind of moving in this almost like figure eight pattern, switching stances a lot, but he is feinting kicks constantly, and for a guy who has really good boxing, that's just a great way to almost feint your way on the inside to get to where you're good at to begin with. And that's what's going to be the interesting thing about this fight, because I'm going to say something that might seem controversial, but then I'm going to explain my point. I actually think Randy Costa has more power than Adrian Yanez in this fight. I do think that the timing and the speed, though, lies with Adrian Yanez. I really do feel like the hand speed of Adrian Yanez is the thing that puts his power up to the next level, because if anything is true in MMA, it's that speed kills. If you don't see the shot coming, it's going to hurt you that much worse. And that's what Adrian Yanez has basically made his young career off of up until this point. He's not only a great boxer, he's a phenomenal counter striker. And I'm actually going to steal something that Luke Thomas brings up all the time. He likes to strike on the half beat. You see a lot of fighters, this is going to sound, I'm going to go on a Robin Black tangent. Fighting can be like dancing where there's a rhythm sometimes, and you can tell that when guys step, they almost have a rhythm to their fight. Adrian Yanez is great at breaking up his opponent's rhythm, and it's not something you often see from an unranked fighter.
There's a fighter that you see, and this is at the upper echelon, that Adrian Yanez kind of borrows something from, to borrow from the Robin Blacks and Luke Thomas and the great analysts that are out there. You talk about hitting on a half beat. You watch Max Holloway in any of his fights. The Brian Ortega one's a good example. I'll go with Calvin Kattar because, well, the Boston connection or the Massachusetts connection, but every time that Kattar would try and do something, Holloway's going 1-2, and then as Kattar's walking away, bang, bang, I'm throwing an extra couple. Adrian Yanez does exactly that. You see that in the fight against Rodriguez. It's like, okay, he's done. I can kind of move away, and then bang, you get hit by a head kick, and you're floored, and you're knocked out. Adrian Yanez's last fight is the one that, it didn't win me over. I think I was already won over. We had the conversation with him in This Week in MMA. It's a lot of fun. You can check it out.
And he has quite a bit to say about one half of this weekend's main event as well.
He does. And you know what? That's a good time. Let's clip that one in right now.
Really, you're in one of the busiest divisions in the sport. It's popping off. You get TJ Dillashaw coming back into the fold in the new year. What's your take on the top tier of the division and the return of the former champion TJ Dillashaw?
I'll speak of the state of the division first, then I'll answer the TJ Dillashaw. The state of the division, man, it's nothing but killer city, man. It's all killers. There's no, like, even in the top 30, you got nothing but killers. You know, I consider myself like one of those killers as well, man. There's like a whole list of people. And like in the top 15, any one of those guys can beat each other on any given day. And that actually like really excites me because it gives me something to work forward and work towards too. It's like, oh man, like dude, like look at the Sean O'Malley and Chito Vera like fight. Dude, nobody really knew like Chito Vera like that until after he did that to Sean O'Malley. You know, we all like if you were a fan of the sport and you watched the fights, you knew Chito Vera is a motherfucker, you know? So just like a lot of these guys, you got like Ricky Simon, that guy's a beast. And you got You got all these other fighters. You got Marlon Moraes. You know, even though he kind of fades out, you know, he's still – nobody wants that first round Marlon Moraes. Yeah, like, dude, just look at the top two guys. You got Aljamain Sterling and Peter Yan. Those guys are freaking beast. I personally think that Aljamain might have this one, a five-round decision. But, man, it's a really stacked division, and it really excites me because, man, there's a whole bunch of road killers, and I get to go against those guys, and that freaking excites me because I'm just like, dude, like, this is what I wanted to do. Like, I'm living my dream. I'm going out there, and I get to fight these guys. Like, yeah, like, it's really exciting. The return of TJ Dillashaw on that hand, I don't know. He shouldn't come back to the top. Like, he's saying he should get a title shot, man. I don't think so, man. That yeah, he should get at least a win or two to get himself back in there. But, man, I don't know, man. The guy was trying, like, I heard his interview. I heard a part snippets of his interview. I didn't really hear like too much of his interview. And I'm just saying, I don't know, man. Like in his own head, he was trying to he was saying like, well, if you got away with it, he'd be like, yeah, no, I'd try to find a way to justify. I was like, if you're admitting it, like at least you're man enough to admit it. But at the same time, you get no respect from me. You're out there blatantly cheating. Going out there trying to get ahead of your opponent, and you're trying to cheat the system. I don't like that. I don't like cheaters. You know, I'm a clean guy. I take thorn supplements. You know, provided from the UFC and everything. So, coming from a guy who's at the top of the level, using EPO, you know, it really kind of just pisses me off. You know, because you got to, if you really want to get there, you work hard for it. If you have to take banned substances, dude, just get the fuck out the sport, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry for cussing, man. That was like, shit.
No, man, it's definitely understandable. I mean, you hate to see it, especially at the highest level, like you said.
But his win over Gustavo Lopez, all the Dillashaw stuff aside, was impressive because the real question was, how can Yanez kind of hang with some of these guys that are going to take him down? He had that split decision loss against Miles John with LFA, but he fought big names over there. Like, Kyle Estrada is one of those guys that, hey, did he make it to the UFC or has he made it yet? No, but you look at the guys that Kyle Estrada's fought and you look at the performances that he's put on, they're very impressive. That was a split decision win. Then he ends up in the big show. And you've seen those finish wins, even the one on Contender Series after Estrada to beat Brady Huang, where he sends him to the shadow realm. It's incredibly impressive. So Randy Costa, a little bit more kickboxing. Adrian Yanez, from what we've seen, just a strict boxing. But I still, style for style, this is such a great fight. And like you said, you got Costa coming in here at 27. You got Yanez at 27. Peak powers right now. I can't wait for this fight.
The last time we had a fight kind of similar to this is when the UFC tried to put Brandon Thatch and Stephen Wonderboy Thompson in like a weird main event. This was years ago, and then Wonderboy ended up falling out, and they did Benson Henderson versus Brandon Thatch. Flexing a little bit of MMA knowledge right there. But it's the truth. Like, these are two genuine prospects, and I'm going to say this right now. No matter what the result is this Saturday, I honestly think both guys will be ranked at some point, and I could see these guys having a rematch later on when they both are ranked. Because A, this is one of those rivalries that anybody can get along for because there's really no bad blood. They're just two really high quality prospects. And we don't have this as a fight of the night contender because we think Yanez is just going to run over Costa. I will say I favor Yanez ever so slightly because this is the really big X factor I'm going to come down to. The fact that Randy Costa actually switches his stances, I think will be a mild detriment to him in this fight. Because something we see often out of guys who do switch stances is that defensively they're extremely sound in one version of that stance, and then they will suffer slightly in the other version of their stance. I'm not saying Randy Costa is one of those guys, but if you are, Adrian Yanez is going to expose it. He's going to force you, the natural kickboxer, to become a boxer. I really do think Adrian Yanez is going to crowd the space as much as he can on a guy like Randy Costa. And if he can turn this into a boxing fight, which is really dangerous against a guy like Randy Costa, and honestly, most other guys in the division, I wouldn't say, hey, turn it into a boxing fight against Randy Costa. But I really do think if Yanez can get on the inside, his hand speed will be shown off to huge effect.
If you see it for Randy Costa, a lot of sites are going to have him out of Lozon's Mixed Martial Arts. He's actually at a Sanford MMA. He's one of three fighters that I could find on this card, and the other two, they're actually matched up to fight each other. We did a prediction video, Ian Heinisch and Brendan Allen both fighting out of Sanford for their fights on this card, not against each other. So that could be a great thing for Costa. Implement some of those leg kicks. Man, who's a great leg kicker there? Well, Jason Jackson's good at everything. He's my premier Sanford guy, but Gilbert Burns, the list goes on. Great fighters there. I love the fight. In terms of the odds, Adrian Yanez is the favorite. Open to minus 170. He's minus 196 right now. For Costa, open to plus 145. He's a plus 161. I don't want to look at the topology votes because it hurts my feelings. This is the definition of a Dr. Pepper and Reese's Pieces fight. Not a sponsor, so just throw that one out of there. But it's our pop and popcorn for sure. When I look at the fan vote, 663 total votes, 85% Yanez, 70% by knockout. For the 15% that have Costa, 45% by decision, and 46% by knockout, Matt, it has to be said, all of his wins are in the first round, and his one loss is in the second. I like the fact that Yanez has fought a five-round fight in the past against Miles Johns. His fight in the main event against Estrada was only a three-rounder, but Adrian Yanez has the experience. I like that as a factor, but if Costa goes out there and starts to pepper the legs, work the body, work his kicks into this game, Costa definitely has an opportunity as a dog. I love the fight. I'm going Yanez, but I think it's a really close one.
Yeah, this fight should be amazing. Again, I am ever so slightly going to pick Adrian Yanez, but this is one of those fights where I would not be surprised no matter how it does end. Again, I do feel like the hand speed of Yanez is going to be the overall big factor in this fight. Even go back to the Brandon Davis fight for Randy Costa, and I know you can't take a lot from that fight because it was on such short notice for Costa, but Davis was able to hurt him when he was able to make it into a boxing fight, when he was able to get on the inside of the range. And the other thing that Yanez does, kind of similarly to Davis, oddly enough, he does go to the body with his boxing combinations, and that was something that Davis was able to do to full effect against Costa. Again, should be a great fight, but final prediction, I like Adrian Yanez.
Both of us going ever so slightly with Houston's own Adrian Yanez to get the win. Can't wait for the fight. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have and whether you prefer Dr. Pepper's 23 flavors to Reese's Pieces. We're going soft drink versus food. It's a weird battle. You let us know. I love this one. And at the top, a bantamweight banger, Corey Sandhagen taking on TJ Dillashaw. You're not going to want to miss this. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Matt, big time fight coming up in middleweight this weekend. We have the Hurricane Ian Heinisch, the former LFA middleweight champion. He's going to be taking on France's Nassourdine Imavov. And Matt, for Imavov, there's guys that I have like in my Rolodex that I reference a lot. And maybe Nassourdine Imavov doesn't come out that often, but he's one of those guys that I've had my eye on for a really long time. Ever since he fought with Aris FC, well, really, even before that. But when he fought for Aris, he fought a guy named Jonathan Mounier. And if you're Robin Black, you call him Joe.
He goes by Joe. His name is Jonathan Mounier. His friends call him Joe.
If you go back and watch that fight, Mounier had a long time off between fights. He actually had a fight against Colby Covington, and that was his lone loss in the UFC. He had an odd brain condition. The UFC released him, and then he ended up fighting Imavov. So I had a lot of respect for Mounier. He was one of those guys that I wanted to see progress and fight more in the UFC. But boom, we get this new startup. Rudrug's fighting for them. I'm excited. And Nassourdine Imavov looked great against him. His striking, his in and out movement, his long stance, his long punches. There's so much to like out of Nassourdine Imavov. Now, I went back and I watched his last fight. He ended up losing to Phil Haas, and it was a majority decision. One of the judges scored at 28-28. The other two had it 29-28. I controversially on Twitter had it for Imavov.
He didn't win.
But I saw a lot of arguments for Haas, and the majority did have Haas to win that fight. But regardless, Imavov struggled with the pressure of Phil Haas in that fight.
It was a really weird fight, and it was one of those fights where, listen, I didn't have a horse in the race, but I found myself screaming at the TV because it was one of those cases where Phil Haas is exhausted in the third round. Imavov's moving forward on him, hitting him with every shot he lands, and then just decides, oh, let's not go for the kill. It was weird because if he put his foot all the way down, he probably would have gotten Phil Haas out of there, and we'd be talking about Nassourdine Imavov in a very different light. But it was true. In the first two rounds, he really did struggle with the pressure of Phil Haas. Which takes us to the other side of this fight. What's Ian Heinisch really good at, if nothing else? Well, he does pressure forward. Now, he does do it at this, like, weird labored pace. And I know I bring this up all the time, where, like, when Dustin Poirier fights, people are like, hey, he looks tired 3 minutes in. He doesn't. If you just watch him fight enough, I don't know if it's, like, a timing thing. I don't know what it is. But some fighters, even Dominic Cruz, known for great cardio, huff and puffs throughout his fights. Ian Heinisch is weird, because it feels like he starts the fight at, like, a 7 out of 10 for cardio, and then he just never gets better or worse. It's really weird.
For Ian Heinisch, you know the life story by now. We don't have to break it down piece by piece, but maybe it's like the Wim Hof breathing techniques. Maybe that's what he likes. It's almost like Nicholas Dalby in his last fight. The commentary never stopped talking about how odd he was breathing but he does it every single fight. The difference maker for Ian Heinisch, we've seen different fighting styles out of him. We've seen him wrestled. We've seen him get out wrestled. We've seen him as a Muay Thai striker, like when he fought Gerald Meerschaert, and he had pretty well a full training camp out of Tiger Muay Thai. In his last fight, he took on Kelvin Gastelum, and Gastelum out wrestled him, which might have surprised a lot of people. But if you go back through Kelvin Gastelum's career, yes, he's a great southpaw striker, and he's one of the best in tight, especially with his uppercuts. Okay. But his bread and butter is actually his wrestling, and he used it to great effect. So for Heinisch in this fight, not training out of Colorado, he's actually at a Sanford MMA, training with one of his, well, former opponents he was supposed to take on a couple of different times, Brendan Allen. He's supposed to fight Allen, ended up with Gastelum. You go over to Ian Heinisch over on the Instagrams, and he's got a picture with Henry Hooft, and he's working out with Sean Soriano, and I've seen Sean Soriano also hold mitts for Brendan Allen. I don't know why he's a sucker for punishment, moving up 40 pounds, holding mitts for these guys, but I'd like to see that out of Heinisch, that he's making the move over to Sanford. For Nasruddin Imavov, you might have a scary post on the Instagram. I don't know if I actually like it, and I'm going to put it up on screen, so I'll show you this, but Petit Passage par la Casse Chirurgie en effet, je me suis mal contrairement cassé la main à l'entraînement, l'opération est très bien passée et soyez en sûr, je ferai tout pour revenir à 200%. So he's going to come back at 200%. Broke his right hand training 13 weeks ago. Now, he put that one on Instagram 13 weeks ago. So did he break it 13 weeks ago? Instagram's a bit of an odd trap. You can get stuck looking at Paige Van Zandt videos all day. I don't know if I'd love to see that he broke his hand 13 weeks ago. I'd rather he didn't break it.
I gotta let something out of the bag right now. I've never looked at Instagram and have that sway my opinion on a fight. I understand sometimes you might be able to take some from it, but you can put anything on there. People only put things on there that are positive and that they want other people to see. No one's not posting training videos and then they didn't have a training camp. Like, to me, I just can't put a lot into their social media. What I do know is that Imavov does struggle with larger pressure fighters in the cage, and I know that's what I normally get out of a fighter in Ian Heinisch. It was a little upsetting, I should say, because it's weird. Ian Heinisch almost came into the UFC as that kind of like, hey, I'm well-rounded, I can strike with you, but when it push comes to shove, I will kind of get into that grinding style of wrestling. But we've seen him get beat twice that way, and it is weird. I know Omari Akhmedov does that to most guys, so it's not the end of the world, but the fact that Gastelum, he did outbox him in that fight, but he did out-wrestle him, it was just a weird thing to see from Heinisch. The one thing I will say, and we do have to go back a little ways, I know he lost to Derek Brunson, but he did drop him with a head kick in the start of that fight, and I actually thought he looked all right in the beginning of the fight until you could just tell. The fact that Derek Brunson has so much high-level experience was really able to win out in that fight. But I really do think that the package of Ian Heinisch is a borderline top 15 fighter. I'm not saying he's ever going to get into the top 15 or cause a lot of noise in the top 15, but I do think he'd be one of those, like, oh, Ian Heinisch is 13th this week.
He's been there before.
Exactly, and I think he can get there again, and I really do think that this performance or this fight against Nasruddin Imavov is going to be one step towards a ranking.
To me, they're not doing Imavov any favors, None. Which is weird, because I think he has some potential. Like, well, it's an odd pairing.
The UFC is one of those few companies where people like to say, oh, the NHL's global or NBA's global. The UFC is truly a global sport, and the fact that now MMA is legal in France, you'd think they'd want to promote a France star, but yeah, it is weird. It's just, this is weird matchmaking.
We look at the odds, Heinisch open, a minus 115, just a slight favorite. He's now minus 150. For Nasruddin Imavov, open a minus 105. He's a plus 123 or thereabouts on best fight odds. The total votes over on Tapology, 659 votes, 72% have Heinisch, the majority, 84% have the win by decision. For the 28% that have Imavov, 75% by decision. And if you look at it for Ian Heinisch, Matt, I mean, decision losses all the way through. He lost to Marcus Perez by triangle when he was with LFA. And for Nasruddin Imavov, the losses, but one by decision. Two by decision, one by submission. I'd like it to go the distance. I think Ian Heinisch is going to grind him out here in this fight. I don't like the fact that he had to, casser son main là. I didn't like that at all. And I don't think that's a great thing to find on the socials when you're doing your deep dive for the fights. So I like Heinisch in this one.
I'm just going to expand on one thing that you said. I love the Sanford MMA connection with Ian Heinisch, because if you looked at his performance leading up to the Gerald Meerschaert fight, the big key to that was, oh, he went to Thailand. He trained in Thailand and got his Muay Thai better. If you want to continue getting better Muay Thai but not want to go to Thailand, one of the best places in the world to do it would be Sanford MMA. Tons of great training partners around his size, too, and I really think that's the important thing. A lot of guys will be at gyms and they'll be like, oh, this guy's a Team Alpha male. It's like, well, that's weird. He's a middleweight. Why is he training with a bunch of featherweights? The fact that Ian Heinisch is at a primary... I know it's changed recently, but still. The fact that Ian Heinisch is with a lot of guys, like the Jason Jacksons, like the Gilbert Burns of the world, a lot of guys around his size, he's going to be able to train with day in and day out. I really like that out of Heinisch, and I do think we're going to see an improved fighter this time out.
Matt, it pains me to say, Imavov is one of my guys, but I'm going with Ian Heinisch in this fight. You're in agreement here as well, and we've got a full slate of fights coming up. There's 13 on this card right now, so you're not going to want to miss any of them. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it.
They say the sun's out, bums are out, and hopefully your pubes are not out. And also, flip-flop season is upon us. And listen, you're out here with those post-pandemic toenails. Nobody wants that. So don't worry, because our friends at Manscaped, they've got you covered. They just launched their fourth generation performance package and their Shears 2.0 nail grooming kit. Join the Manscaped movement by going to manscaped.com for 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP. It's just as simple as that. Now, listen, we've all been there. You're trimming your nuts, Matt. And I used to go with the department store brand trimmer. It was all shiny and metallic. And then I would use it in the shower a couple times. It would get rusty. And then you're tossing 30, 40 bucks right out the door. And it always sucks. And it always happens. And they're just not up to snuff with the Manscaped Performance Package. They're just not up to snuff with the performance package that we have in front of us here that comes with a special gift being the Shed Travel Bag. But inside, Matt, look at that, the 4.0. This is a great trimmer. Why is it a great trimmer? Because boom, you have that great LED spotlight. It's a 4,000K LED spotlight, but I can tell you one thing for certain. I'm going to be traveling this week, so if there's any fights that fall under or there's anything added, I will be doing it remotely. The nice thing, though, about it is I'm going to be bringing the Lawnmower 4.0, and if you triple tap this, and you'll see it, 1, 2, 3, boom, boom, boom. The light lights up, and now it won't come on. Ooh. See that? There's a travel lock on this. See, it's going to show you. It's going to pop up. You go 1, 2, 3. It's going to pop down, and then if I start it, there we go. We're all good to go. So you don't want to have any ingrown hairs or snags on your boys before beach season, and that's why that Lawnmower 4.0 with the 7,000 RPM motor, the on-off travel lock, and it also gives you the opportunity to use that spotlight. If the power grid goes out in Texas again, you can use your Lawnmower 4.0 to illuminate the way with this LED spotlight. They wrote that. Little insensitive. They wrote it. I'm reading the copy. But either way, the trimmer is also waterproof, so you can trim in the shower, and don't worry about your cleanup on aisle D. They also wrote that. The other nice thing about it, they didn't rate this. You can pop the cover off. You can clean inside. You can oil the motor if you really need to. To put it back on, fairly simple. I popped it back on just like that. Again, I can't stress how good that travel lock is. And if you also go through the performance package, what did I have early on? It's like a tickle trunk from Mr. Dress Up. Don't take that the wrong way. Canadian CBC show, but the Weed Whacker.
You can hear it work.
You really can. And I've been a nose hair problem. And listen, I know that sounds strange, but I have one and I've been one. This has really helped alleviate some of those issues. And again, if you pick out the Performance Package 4.0, the Manscaped Boxers will be coming with it.
And of course,
I'm wearing them right now. We can see that.
You can see it right in there.
Stretchy fabric. They fit really well. They also come with a Shed Travel Bag. And listen, you need a nice toiletry bag when you're traveling. This week, I'm going to bring it with me. Also included in that performance package, you have the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's like a salve. You just put it on, slap that stuff on. It also comes with the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. And Matt, you just spritz a little bit on in the morning. You let it dry out. Maybe you air dry. If you're in a hotel room like me, you'll pace back and forth 20 times. There's let it dry. You're going to have a really nice day. And again, they talked about it, but the Shears as well. The Shears 2.0, it's a luxury four-piece nail kit featuring tempered stainless steel tools. It also includes the slash tip tweezers, rounded point scissors, fingernail clippers, and a medium grit nail file. You're probably wearing flip-flops, and people don't want to see those nasty unclipped toes of yours. So get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Tame that summer swamp in your pants with Manscaped. Matt,
It's been a pleasure having Manscaped on board. The products are great. So if you check them out, you're supporting Manscaped. You're also supporting the boys at Fight Night Picks. So make sure you check them out. Manscaped.com, promo code FNP, 20% off and free shipping. We get two big time fights left to talk about. Ladd taking on a very tough test in Macy Chasson. And in the main event, TJ Dillashaw making his return, taking on Corey Sandhagen. You're not going to want to miss that. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
A big-time fight between big-time gyms. This weekend, we have Puna Soriano representing Extreme Couture, taking on All In Brandon Allen. He's All In this time with Sanford MMA. This is a guy that spent a lot of time at Rufus Sport. He's made the move, and I absolutely love it. Now, his former common opponent, but the fight fell out twice, Ian Heinisch, is also at the gym training at Sanford. You love it, especially in some of the higher weight classes, and we can talk about that till the cows come home. But both of these guys, Matt, have entered into the DMs. Well, not really the DMs. They've entered into the comment sections on YouTube. They've ripped us apart.
They have.
And rightfully so, because I've had weird reads on Brandon Allen. And likewise, weird reads on Punahele Soriano in the UFC. For Soriano, he beat Jonathan Pate with LFA. He beat Jamie Pickett on Dana White's Contender Series. Then it's big wins over Oscar Piotta and Dusko Todorovic in his last time out. For Brandon Allen, it seems like he's been in the UFC forever. He beats Kevin Holland in the 5-on-in. He beats Tom Breeze. He beats Kyle Dox. He loses to Sean Strickland. And then he beat Carl Robertson his last time out. Matt, what can you tell me about Brandon Allen?
He looked phenomenal his last time out against Carl Robertson, but it was weird because that was almost like another reinvented version of Brandon Allen that we've seen. And this is kind of the question that I guess I'll just leave out there. Is Sanford Brandon Allen like this new animal? Because he was there for the Carl Robertson fight, and I know we didn't see a lot of his striking in that fight, but from what we did see, he looked really good. And that's the weird thing about Brandon Allen, and I can kind of say a little bit about this, but Punahele Soriano, but let me get to that in a second. With Brandon Allen, it all comes down to his fight IQ. It really does, because if you go to the Kevin Holland fight, I understand he beat Kevin Holland, but he beat him in the dumbest way possible. Like, he gets dropped by Kevin Holland on the feet, gets hurt by him, gets out-grappled, and then is eventually able to out-grapple Kevin Holland. Honestly, that win for Brandon Allen came down to the fact that Kevin Holland had a bad game plan. Let's look at Punahele Soriano really quick, and let's look at his last fight. I understand he knocked out Dusko Todorovic, and Dusko was a prospect that a lot of people were high on, myself included, and Punahele Soriano looked phenomenal in that fight. But did Punahele look good in that fight, or did Dusko just look really bad? This is the thing. It's true. Punahele looked good in that fight, but he landed one technique over and over and over again. It's not like he set that technique up. He just couldn't miss his left hook. And it wasn't the fact that, oh, I'm going to the body, then I'm setting up my left hook, kind of like Stipe did against Daniel Cormier in their second fight. It was, I'm just going to keep on throwing the left hook, and my opponent's hands are never going to come up. This is the weird thing about Punahele Soriano, and I'm going to let this out of the, I'm going to let the cat out of the bag right now. I don't really know how to base him off his last performance, because if you go back to the Oscar Piotta performance, well, Oscar Piotta was known for one thing in the UFC and one thing only, getting finished brutally by a lot of guys. And if you go to the Dusko fight, did Punahele look really good in that fight, or did Dusko just not really fix the defensive lapse that we were so apparent from the first minute of that fight? So in this fight, this is the ultimate grappler versus striker matchup on this card for me, at least, because I really don't think Brandon Allen can strike with Punahele Soriano for rounds. I think he can do it for minutes or maybe even seconds, but I really don't think he should find himself in a striking battle with a guy like Punahele Soriano, who's as heavy-handed as he is so early in his transition to Sanford MMA. The last thing I'm going to say, Eddie Bravo said something that's always going to stick with me. He said, when I have a striker who comes into my gym who wants to learn jiu-jitsu, I don't tell him to pull guard his first fight with me. I use that 6 months that we have together to get him better at jiu-jitsu. I hope he doesn't have to show up for a couple fights, though, because let's say he wins the next fight and doesn't show his jiu-jitsu, then I get another 6 months with that guy to get a little bit better, get a little bit better. I'm sure Brandon Allen's striking has gotten a lot better since he moved down to Sanford MMA, but I don't think this is the fight that he should all of a sudden start going out and working behind the jab, peppering in body kicks.
Yeah, because it didn't work for him against Sean Strickland, and that's the really tricky thing. A lot of people are very down because of that performance, and then flip forward, you take on the glory kickboxer and Carl Robertson, and he looked really good in that one. I look at the odds for this one. Allen opened a plus 185 underdog. He's minus 107 right now. For Puna Soriano, open minus 220. He's now minus 115, and it's not like that just jumped and then it's pretty much flat. It's been kind of consistently going towards Brandon Allen. If we look over in Topology for the votes, hey, it's a surprise to us as it is to you. 642 total votes, 61% Soriano, 86% by knockout. For the 39% that have Allen, 51% by submission. And you talked about it. Grappler versus striker. Puna Soriano hasn't been taken down yet in the UFC. Nobody's even tried it. They've been willing to strike. And you look at the last two opponents, Dusko Todorovic is not going to try and take you down. He grinds up against the fence. He does it in just about every fight.
Ask Daquan.
Ask Teddy Ash. You look at his fight against Oscar Piotta. He finishes him violently. Jamie Pickett's a fun fight. For Brendan Allen, though, I like the takedowns out of him. If you look at it in terms of his numbers, Brendan Allen tries for the takedowns a little bit more than the UFC average. He also attempts way more submissions than the UFC average at 2.08 per 15 minutes compared to the average that's 0.58. So for Brendan Allen, he's offensive with the takedowns. As far as his striking, it's a negative strike differential. It's a big positive for Puna Soriano in his shorter sample size. I like Brendan Allen for his work rate. I like him for the takedowns defensively. Maybe short up some of those holes. But again, the red flag on this one is I've had like bad reads on both of these guys that both of these guys have pointed out in the past. So I'll be honest with myself. It's a little tricky, but I like the tool belt that comes in with Brendan Allen here.
So I normally don't get into props or anything, but I don't see this fight going the distance no matter who wins it. Puna has absolutely absurd knockout power. And he does carry it kind of late, to be completely honest. Like, he's not a guy who just goes in there, rushes for that one knockout. He does string together his punches quite a bit, and the fact that he does have a good work rate kind of tells you that he doesn't just have that, kind of burst and then he's done. The weird thing about Brendan Allen, though, is that he can get it to the ground, but he does struggle sometimes when he does go for the takedown. The thing about Brendan Allen is that once he is able to get that takedown to the ground, he doesn't just waste time on top. He's got great ground and pound, and he uses ground and pound to soften his opponent up for the submissions. You're looking at Brendan Allen, you're going to see a lot of submissions on his record, and he's a great submission fighter. But when I think about Brendan Allen, and I know I said grappler versus striker, Brendan Allen to me is kind of, and again, people are going to enjoy this comp, but he does use his ground and pound a lot like Khabib did, where it's, I'm using my ground and pound to soften up my opponent to then move past their guard into side control or mount, and then I'm going to look for the submission. He is really good at softening his opponents up after he gets them down to the mat. So this could be one of those weird fights where it's like Brendan Allen wins the first two rounds but gets knocked out in the third. I'm going to predict Brendan Allen because I do feel like he has the more well-rounded skill set, but I don't have a great read on this fight.
For Puna Soriano, 7 of his wins are by finish, and all 7 in the first round. I find it odd that you think that he has
the staying power. But in the Jamie Pickett fight, he showed that he's not a guy who just gets tired in one big burst in the first round. I understand a lot of his wins come by first round knockout. That's just because if he lands his power early, there's not a lot of guys who can take that power and continue late. I think with a guy like Brendan Allen, he can at least eat a few of those shots. I do worry about Brendan Allen in that third round. We saw against Sean Strickland.
Saw it against Dawkins as well.
Well, exactly. But the thing about Dawkins was that he at least grappled with Brendan Allen. I don't think Soriano will have any success grappling with Allen, just like I don't think Allen will have a lot of success if he just tries to throw bombs in the feet. Again, ever so slightly pick Brendan Allen, because if he does need to go to a plan B, or if he does need to take this fight to the ground, I think he will be able to. But this fight should be fun for as long as it lasts. I
absolutely
really
love this one. These guys are uber talented. We're both going ever so slightly with our cousin from Louisiana, Brendan Allen, to get the win. No, there's no relation. I love this fight. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have, and we keep on moving. We got big time fights on this card that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. There's a fight this weekend that I've circled on my card at welterweight that I am going to be watching. You don't want to take a bathroom break. We have Mickey Gall taking on Beaumaye Jordan Williams. Matt, do I like the game? No, answer the question.
Yeah?
Yeah, kind of. But I love that song, Ali Beaumaye. Cool nickname, but for Jordan Williams, I look at this fight, he's the definition of a killer be killed fighter. And this one is, like I said, taking place at welterweight, not at middleweight. And this is Jordan Williams' first fight at 170 pounds since Conquer FC 2, when he got knocked out in the first round by Dwight Grant back in 2016. So it's been a while. He came into the UFC with a knockout win over Gregory Rodriguez, who looked amazing in his UFC debut. First round knockout in that one. He lost to Nassourdine Imavov his last time out. What can you tell me about Jordan Williams?
Jordan Williams is a very, very fun fighter. And like you said, he is kill or be killed. He is one of those weird fighters who will give up defense in pursuit of offense. And that is going to get him caught against the upper echelon of fighter in this division. Like, if Jordan Williams fought Santiago Ponzinibbio, Rubio this weekend, then maybe I'd be a little bit hesitant on him and his ceiling in the division. But the fact that they're matching him up with Mickey Gall, who is still very green in his MMA career, I really do think this is perfect matchmaking by the part of the UFC. The weird thing about Mickey Gall is that, and here, for anyone who doesn't like basketball, let me get these references out of the way now. If you know who Ben Simmons is at all in basketball, he's a great talent, but he can't shoot at all. And he's this weird player who, if you looked at the rookie version of him 5 years ago and looked at the player today, they're basically the same guy. And I'm asking myself that about Mickey Gall, because Mickey Gall, I'm sure, has developed since the fighter who fought Mike Jackson back in 2016, who fought CM Punk all the way back when. But he hasn't really shown it in the cage, and that is the one thing that I always have to come back to. Like, Mickey Gall, if he has been in the UFC for the last 5 years, should at least have a competitive fight with a guy like Mike Perry, who does seem to sort of be on his way out, if anything. He got absolutely dominated by Mike Perry and didn't even have a minute in that fight where I could have scored for Mickey Gall.
Now, that's because Mike Perry had a great corner. That's why he won that fight. But you're right. I mean, you look at it. For Mickey Gall, he beat Ron Templeton at Dead Series 17 on Dana White's Looking for a Fight. They sign him at 1-0. He beats Mike Jackson by first-round finish, Chick Magnet Punk by first-round finish, Sage Northcutt by second-round finish. That was emo Sage in that fight. That was a really weird one. But since then, he loses to Randy Brown at UFC 217. Well, I'm fine with that. Randy Brown's a good fighter. That's not just in Craig's mind's eye. Randy Brown's proven that he's a good fighter. Look at his single-arm submission win over Alex Oliveira's last time out. He beats George Sullivan, who was then on his way out of the UFC. He gets finished by Diego Sanchez. He beats one of the worst fighters that was on the roster at the time, and Salim Tuari, whose cardio was awful, and that was a terrible fight. It really was. And then he was booked against Carlos Condit, Alex Oliveira. The fights fell through. He gets Mike Perry, and he lost in emphatic fashion. He was then booked against Miguel Baeza.
Oh, he's lucky that fight fell through.
That fight fell through. Gall withdrew. So now he gets Jordan Williams. And I said about Williams, he has a bit of a wrestling background. And this is funny. I never go here for info. But the UFC's Jordan Williams page in the Q&A section. When and why did you start training for fighting? I started fighting when I was 19 years old. The reason why I started fighting was because a friend brought up the idea to me, and I was screwed out of a full-ride scholarship to UC Davis when they dropped the wrestling program due to lack of funds. Got a wrestling background. Like that, as far as his defensive chops are concerned, his head movement's not great. He gets hit a lot on the feet. He had 3 shots to make the UFC on Dana White's Contender Series. The last one was the golden ticket. For Jordan Williams, I've seen him lose by finish to Kazula Vargas. I went back and watched that fight because it was wild. I know if you look at it, it was a doctor's stoppage. There was blood. It was a Tachi Palace. He's got some decent wins. He's got some striking. He's bringing it in against Mickey Gall, who, and this is where I want to hand it off. More than just a week ago, I'm talking weeks and weeks ago, Mickey Gall looking bodied up and training with Matt Brown at Immortal Martial Arts. He's also training out of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu as well. Matt Brown making the trip between the two and training with him. What do you like about that?
One of the things they brought up when Adolfo Vieira fought this past weekend was that he sat down with someone and they made his last loss unavoidable. They sat him down and they made him watch it. They made him say, hey, failure is okay, but the fact that you failed that one time means that you can be better in the future. Mickey Gall's never really shown that. And the problem about that Mike Perry fight is that if you're going to have any success against Mike Perry, if you're Mickey Gall, it would have to be in the grappling. You would think, oh, if it hits the mat, Mickey Gall should have success no matter if he's on the bottom or the top. Mike Perry got offensive takedowns on Mickey Gall and held him down. Mike Perry's an okay offensive wrestler, and I honestly think that's probably the most underrated aspect of his game. But still, if you're being held down by a guy like Mike Perry, I just feel like it tells us that you haven't developed enough in your career. Now, having Matt Brown in his corner, I do think is a big thing, because Matt Brown is going to sit you down, and he's going to make sure that your losses are unavoidable. He's not going to let you hide from your losses and just show up to the gym every day like, that was the old version of me, I'm a new guy. Matt Brown still knocks people out in the UFC, and he's in his 40s, okay? Marin Renault couldn't do that. Not to talk bad about Marin Renault, but still, Matt Brown is a guy who is still very competitive, even though he is later on into his career, because he still trains absolutely crazy every single day. And he's a guy who still does try to incorporate new things into his game. I feel like that is a good move for Mickey Gall, and I feel like it will help him, but I just don't think it's going to be enough. I think Mickey Gall's one of those cases where he got signed to the UFC too early, and he was never able to develop because he was in there with guys who were either way too good or other guys who weren't really UFC caliber. It's not his fault. It's the UFC for putting him in that position. It's just the position he was put in, and I don't think this fight against Jordan Williams is going to get him back on track.
Gall's had a really weird time because he was the guy that would train all around. I remember getting ready for some of the Mickey Gall fights and going, okay, well, now he's in California. He's training with Joe Schilling,
the
of
BMF
all people.
Ranch?
Joe Schilling was just cornering Daniel Rodriguez last weekend when he knocked out Preston Parsons. That was disgusting.
Didn't need to see that fight.
Stop bringing guys in on short notice like that. But in a fight like this, it is slightly evenly matched. You have the more striking, heavy-handedness out of Jordan Williams. Mickey Gall can strike, but again, his bread and butter is his ground game and his jiu-jitsu. The odds in this one have Williams, who opened at minus 150, is minus 209 on best fight odds. For Mickey Gall, open to plus 130, is plus 170. Over on Tapology, surprise to us as it is to you, I scroll down.
Yeah.
687 total votes, 66% Williams, 50% by decision, 45% by knockout. For the 34% that have Gall, 51% by decision, 37% by submission. I like Jordan Williams in this fight. If you look at Mickey Gall's losses, again, Randy Brown by decision, Diego Sanchez by ground and pound, Mike Perry by decision. I think Jordan Williams might end up on top. If he gets submitted, he gets submitted. But if you look at it for Williams so far, he got knocked out by Dwight Grant, doctor stoppage against Vargas, had the fight against Tim Caron that ended up going to a no contest, and even if you look into it at that point, maybe you forget about those early contender series fights. It was originally a win for Williams. It was overturned to a no contest because, of course, Jordan Williams hit that sticky icky. So, Matt, we're at this point right now where Williams had those three fights. He ends up losing against Nassourdine Imavov in his last time out. What are you saying here?
Just because you lose to Nassourdine Imavov doesn't mean you're going to lose to to Mickey Gall. The thing is, I don't think Mickey Gall was ever UFC caliber. It sucks to say. I take no pleasure saying it, but it's the truth. Like, he came in with one UFC win. He came in with one MMA win, I should say, not even a UFC win. He beat Mike Jackson. Is Mike Jackson UFC caliber? Is CM Punk UFC caliber? And was Sage Northcutt UFC caliber? None of those three fighters were. And again, none of this is Mickey Gall's fault. It's just the fact that with all that Tuesday contendership, it was the looking for a fight hype. They were trying to push all these young fighters. They were looking for the next Conor McGregor. Conor just stepped away, and the UFC was looking for young stars. So they brought in all these young stars, and unfortunately, not a lot of them have really worked out. It sucks to say. It's just, I really do think Jordan Williams is a lot closer to Matt Brown than Mickey Gall is, and for all those reasons, I think Williams is going to be able to get it done.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight. We're both going with Jordan Williams, but I wouldn't expect to strike it rich with this fight. Now, Matt, we got some big time bangers on this card, including our main event between Corey Sandhagen and TJ Dillashaw. You're not going to want to miss that. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
On this card, we have two big prospect versus prospect fights. Randy Costa taking on Adrian Yanez and Macy Barber. The nickname's the future. She wanted to become the youngest UFC champion, younger than Jon Jones. Slightly derailed are her plans with two losses in a row. She's taking on Miranda Fear the Maverick. And for Miranda Maverick, Matt made a really good point. The UFC had a show at the end of 2020. And who was Jon Anik? Well, cat's out of the bag, but who was Sean Hannock's big prospect that he talked about on that show?
He said Miranda Maverick quite possibly could be the second best women's flyweight in the world right now, only behind Valentina Shevchenko herself.
After one UFC performance, how crazy is that?
It's wild, and here's the thing. Miranda Maverick's UFC debut was against Liliana Jojua, who is a good fighter, don't get me wrong, but it was wild that Sean Hannock put that kind of a ceiling next to Maverick after the one fight. Now, exactly, let's break down that fight really quick. Miranda Maverick's one of these weird fighters where she's a genuine knockout threat at this weight class, and honestly, we should say that for both of these women, and that's why this fight is so exciting. It's not often we have a women's flyweight fight where both fighters could honestly win by knockout in the first, second, or third round, just win by finish in the first, second, or third round, and that's why this fight should be so good.
It's weird, too, because if you look at it for Miranda Maverick, the path to the UFC, there were some losses. She lost to Brogan Walker Sanchez, a fighter that a lot of people have on their records, who was undefeated at the time, and Deanna Bennett, a tough, gritty veteran back in 2019. What does Maverick do at 4-2? Again, she's a very hyped prospect at this point. She beats Heather Walker Leahy. Oh, that Leahy. And then she is involved in Matt's favorite tournament, the Phoenix Series number 2, the one-round fights. She beats Victoria Leonardo, who's now in the UFC. She beats Shayna Young, who's now in the UFC. She gets her revenge over Deanna Bennett. That's great. She finishes her. She beats Pearl Gonzalez. Boom, you're into the UFC. Off to the races. Beats Liana Jojua. Beats Jillian Robertson, and that's where this fight gets funky. Look at Miranda Maverick's Instagram, and other than the poses where she looks great physically, you know exactly what kind of shape she's going to show up to in her fights, she trains out of the house of Muay Thai. Now, the best thing that I love to see is when fighters decide, I'm going to make a little bit of a change. I'm going to work with somebody a little bit different for this fight. You go over to it, she's at the PI, she's training with Aspen Ladd, Andrea Lee, big names, but Matt, some of the names that I've also seen in some of these pictures, and I'm going to throw it up there on the screen, is a picture from a week ago. So glad I could have the Savage come train with me this week in preparation for my upcoming fight. They fought. They had a competitive fight. It was back and forth. There were opportunities for both, but Miranda Maverick with Dean Thomas and Jillian Robertson, I love to see that when you can all of a sudden, hey, I had success in the grappling. Jillian had a little bit of success too. I know how good of a striker I am. I think that's a perfect person to bring into a fight like this because you know Macy Barber's going to bring those takedowns. You know Macy Barber's going to bring the fire on the feet. I think Robertson's a great person to train with, and a lot of people might be down on Robertson right now. I think that's a great move.
I do it too, but here's the flip side of that. Macy Barber is actually going to bring in a lot of the same strengths that Jillian Robertson has in the cage. Now, I know a lot of people think of Robertson more for her jiu-jitsu, but Robertson really does just shoot a lot of offensive takedowns, and if she gets them, great. If not, then we kind of see the limitations of her striking. Now, Macy Barber does not have that issue. She's a fighter who, and I'm going to use this term, I always think about this, it's at the start of American Sniper when Bradley Cooper is about to hit the target. But there's a term in that movie that stuck with me because I really do think it applies to MMA. And it's aim big, aim small, miss small. And I really do think that that one term sums up this fight perfectly because Macy Barber, although I do think the power does lie with Macy Barber, she's the type of fighter who just swings wild with every single shot. And if she lands, that's great. But if you miss, you're leaving yourself wide open. What does Miranda Maverick do really well? She's a fighter who throws in combination, keeps things very smooth, and very fast down the middle with her shots, and she is borderline surgical with her elbows, just like Jojoua's nose. That's where I do think this fight's going to come down to. I think Barber could have success on the outside when she is just trying to barrage with her big bombs, but I do think that as this fight gets more technical, when both these fighters do tire, just look at what happened to Macy Barber against Alexa Grasso. I don't think Miranda Maverick can fight on the back foot like Alexa Grasso can, but I think she can put together combinations in a very similar way to Grasso, and that's honestly kind of how I see the rhythm of this fight going.
When I look at this too, it's weird for Barber. She loses to Modafferi where she blows out her ACL. She takes a year off, fights Alexa Grasso. A lot of people thought that was a weird fight to put Barber in. I'm pretty sure we both had Barber. The odds were about split at that point. And you look at this one, listen, it's a long time off. It's about 5 months between fights. Macy Barber's moved from VFS down to Team Alpha Male. I think one of her training partners is a perfect person for this fight, too. It's Poppins. It's Corey McKenna. And that's another really good fighter to have in your corner, in your back pocket. I think it's a great comp for Maverick, though Poppins might be a little bit smaller. It still is a good one, Matt. When I have a look at the odds for this one, they opened and automatically corrected themselves. Maverick opened a plus 180 underdog. She's now a minus 147 favorite. It was just a... And then for Barber, if you want the comparable... Because it went up and down. I'm not a sound effects guy like that guy in... What was it?
It's like Breaking Celery.
Was it Police Academy? Was that the movie where the sound effect guy was in? I'm going to get corrected in the comments section. It's going to be an automatic... But look at it. For Barber, she opened a minus 210. She's now plus 121. If we have a look over on Tapology, it's not a surprise. I will push back. So 742 total votes, 76% Maverick, 77% by decision for the 24% that have Barber, 66% by decision, 24% by knockout. I do think that this fight is a lot closer than maybe those odds or the fans would suggest because I think people are really down on Barber for the last two losses. She's a good opportunity here. I know for Maverick, she gains out in the grappling, but Macy Barber is a very, very good wrestler. We've seen that so far from her in her young UFC career. Even go back to the Hannah Cyphers fight. I'm on top. I'm finishing her. So it will be an interesting fight. What's your final take here?
I like Miranda Maverick in this fight, and honestly, I favor cardio in this fight. The problem with Macy Barber is that as she gets tired, she gets desperate when she rushes forward. Look at the Alexa Grasso fight. It's really the perfect microcosm of her entire career, because it's her walking forward, big
bombs. She does win the last round, though.
That's fine, but she does eat a lot of shots when she moves forward. My issue with Macy Barber isn't with her striking, it's with the defense when she lets her own hands go. She's a fighter who does throw those big windmill-type hooks, and yes, when they land at this weight class, we've seen it happen before. Look at her fight with Jillian Robertson. Like, Jillian Robertson tries to strike with Macy Barber. Barber hits her once, she's completely dazed, and then she just bombs on her up against the cage. If she is able to hit Maverick with a big shot early, I do think she could daze her and then have a little bit of success afterwards, but I really do favor the more crisp striking of Maverick in this matchup.
Barber's only gonna get better. She just turned 23 for Maverick. She just turned, 24 3 weeks ago. So happy birthday to both of them. More so to Maverick because it's closer than to Barber, but I have a hard time with this one. I'm on the fence. I'm going Maverick because, again, It's not just that I like the upside. I like what I've seen in the cage again. She's really tricky. She's tough to hit. And when she's on the ground, sometimes she's in some of those 50-50 exchanges, which makes this one incredibly interesting. But when you line both of these fighters together, you look at the fact that Barber going to switch stances. Maverick out of the southpaw. She's a really tough fighter to take on. That McKenna connection could be good for Barber, so you let us know down below in the comment section. I'm ever so slightly going with Maverick, but I don't have the most confidence in it. We both have Maverick in this fight.
Really fun fight, though.
Eager to get your thoughts on this one as well. We got a great main card coming up, and it is headed off by two absolute legends right now. Sandhagen taking on Dillashaw. Really can't wait for it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at featherweight. We have Darren, and if you didn't know, you can see it on his chest right there. The Damage Elkins taking on Derek Minner, representing Glory MMA and Fitness. And for Derek Minner, you made the change to train with James Krause, and wow, it seems to pay dividends for everybody. The 5-1 in for Derek Minner, if you look at it. A win over Terrence McKinney by submission, where McKinney kind of wrestled with him a little bit, ends up getting submitted in that one. A win over Charlie Dubre, a loss to Grant Dawson in his UFC debut by submission. That was a year and 4 months ago. Beats TJ Laramie as a big underdog. Pats for Patrick. I'll pat myself on the back for that one. I had him to win. And then I'm pretty sure I picked Charles Rosa to beat him, and Derek Minner looked great against Charles Rosa. So I guess you could say we have a hard time with Derek Minner, but man, this guy is such a tricky fighter because if you look at his overall line, 26 wins, 11 losses, but it's so odd because he's almost kill or be killed with a submission, and that's the thing. Of his wins, 22 by submission. Of his losses, 8 by submission. Yeah, you love it, you hate it.
Derek Minner's the type of fighter, to me, where when he's fresh, he is a very dangerous submission threat himself. But if you can get him tired near the end of a fight, he will become a little bit more susceptible, I should say, to the submission himself. But here's the thing. Even Charles Oliveira has submission losses on his record. Like, it's kind of weird, because with Derek Minner, you look at that Grant Dawson fight, and listen, we understand, like, Grant Dawson's that guy when it comes to the grappling.
Knocked out my guy at 155.
He definitely did. Didn't look great up until he did look good. But with Grant Dawson, you know how good his top position is? And he just kind of took the fight out from Derek Minner. It was just one of those classic Grant Dawson fights where he's going to move forward, going to get that takedown. And really, once he gets the takedown, he does have one of those ground games similar to Brendan Allen, to where once he gets his opponent down, he makes them pay for it the second he gets them down. And the problem for Derek Minner, he was just never able to get into a rhythm in that fight. If you look at the flip side, look at the Charles Rosa fight, where he actually kind of flowed with his grappling a little bit, you can see just how dominant he is once the fight gets to the mat. But the question with every Derek Minner fight starts with, A, can he get his opponent to the ground? And that'll be deep with Darren Elkins, because for Darren Elkins, he was that wrestler really throughout his win streak in the UFC, and there have been two versions of Darren Elkins. We'll get to that in a second, but his win streak was nice. I remember the Dennis Bermudez split decision win. I know it was split decision, it was a close fight, but the fact that he beat Dennis Bermudez in a very Dennis Bermudez-y fight, they struck for volume, he out-wrestled Bermudez, it was just a really good win for me. And the weird thing about Darren Elkins, people talk about the damage, they talk about the scar tissue, he has a really good left kick to the body, oddly enough. He throws this really wonky combination where it's like he starts with the right, then he goes left, and then he throws the left body kick. He was actually landing it a lot on the current champ, Alexander Volkanovski. Even Volkanovski was like, some of those kicks did hurt me. Now, Volkanovski dropped Darren Elkins like every single time he hit him in that fight, so there's not a lot of positives to take from it. But I will say, if you're at least able to land a technique on a guy like Alexander Volkanovski consistently throughout a fight, then you should be able to do the same thing to a guy like Derek Minner.
If you look at that win streak, it can't be denied. He beat Robert Whiteford, who was a great fighter. It was a shame the way that things went when he was with ACB, ACA. Beat Chaz Skelly, beat Godofredo Pepe. If you just hear me say that name and you've never seen Godofredo fight, man, that guy put on some absolute bangers. He took on Mirsad Bektic and finished him.
One of the greatest comebacks in UFC history.
Beats Dennis Bermudez, beats Michael Johnson, loses to Volkanovski, loses to Lamas, loses to Hall, loses to Landwehr. When he lost to Landwehr, that's when I thought, ooh, yikes. So he takes some time off. He fights Eduardo Garrigori. Matt, Eduardo Garrigori's at a weird time in the UFC. They brought him in as almost like, it seemed like a necessity. He didn't really put on great performances. Darren Elkins put it on him in that fight. And so Darren Elkins, almost, he's back. He had the 4-fight losing streak. But the weird thing is, he's very, very long in the tooth. He's 37 at this point. Minner coming in at 31. Obviously, I talked about the submission losses. Maybe you don't like to see it. A fun thing that I like to do, go to fightmetric.rds.ca. you can bring up the numbers of what these guys have done so far in the cage. And for Darren Elkins, the sample size is bigger. For Derek Minner, obviously smaller. 65% of the time, it's submissions, either for or against for Minner. 22% are takedowns. 11% of the time, he's striking. 39% of the time for Elkins is submissions. 37% of the time, takedowns. 23% is striking, either for or against. But the majority of the time that these guys are in a cage, somebody's going for a takedown, somebody's going for a submission.
I would just say more grappling than submissions. It's not like in 65% of Derek Minner's fights, he's only either in a rear naked choke or giving a rear naked choke. Like, these stats are a little skewed, but these are two classic grapplers. The problem is that I just think we're past Darren Elkins' prime. Like, his little run there when he fought Bermudez, when he did beat Michael Johnson, there was talks of him fighting Max Holloway at one point and stepping in for Frankie Edgar.
Like, well, he got Alexander Volkanovski.
Darren Elkins was that close to a title shot at one point. It's just, that was a really long time ago. And when your nickname's The Damage, it means that you've accepted a lot of it throughout your career. And yes, he looked good in that Garrigory fight, but I think that fight's kind of like when Matt Brown knocked out Diego Lima. Do I expect a lot of first-round knockouts from Matt Brown moving forward? Not really. I just think he was able to turn back the clock for one performance. I think Darren Elkins is able to take the fight out of Garrigory and really weaponize his pace in that fight, but I really don't think he's going to have that same success as a guy like Derek Minner. If he's all the way on the inside, I don't think he's going to be able to out-grapple a guy like Minner. And on the feet, we've seen Ryan Hall outstrike Darren Elkins. That's a thing we saw in the cage. He wheel kicked him and dropped him, and he threw a bunch of kicks at Elkins, and Elkins didn't know what to do with him. Once we've seen you start to get outstruck by a guy like Ryan Hall, when we've seen you get outgrappled by guys who I think are worse grapplers than Derek Minner, it's really hard for me to pick Darren Elkins against Minner in this fight.
I think Elkins expected a totally different game plan, and the kitchen sink was thrown at him that was in the basement.
But
sink you never see.
Ryan Hall throws kicks and does jiu-jitsu. He's not that hard to game plan for. I understand he's a very tricky fighter, but for Darren Elkins, who is naturally a very, very good wrestler, you would think, okay, all I need to do is focus on the striking of Ryan Hall, and the fact that he looks so bad in that fight really hurt me.
All right, stop digging it, Matt. In this fight, Derek Minner opened a +130. He's a -167 favorite now on average at best fight odds. For Darren Elkins, open a -150. He's +132. We haven't seen the Tapology votes, and I'm eager to see them because I feel like they're going to go one way. 683 total votes, 75% Minner, 69% by decision, 19% by submission. For the 25% that have Elkins, 72% have him to win by decision. I thought the fans were going to have Elkins, actually, in this fight. I've got Minner. Again, I think if we're talking in terms of floating with the grappling, he's well-suited for a fight like this. He's going to give up an advantage in terms of height to Elkins, but reach is the same, and I think on the ground, Derek Minner's a little bit trickier. He's wet on the ground, as they say. That's a weird thing to say, but he is wet on the ground. You got to watch out for him. I like Minner here.
Only two guys have outgrappled Charles Rosa, Bryce Mitchell and Derek Minner. Now, I understand when you're billed as a grappler, it's probably not great that you've been outgrappled twice in recent history, but it's still the truth. Like, Charles Rosa is a very, very skilled grappler, and the fact that Derek Minner not just outgrappled him, like, he dominated him once it went to the mat, it was very, very impressive. And I do feel like if Minner can get this fight to the ground against Elkins, then it'll be very similar to that Rosa performance.
Both of us going with Glory MMA and Fitness own Derek Minner. I'm sure Laura Sanko will have some nice words to say about her teammate if we see her on the call this weekend. Can't wait for the card. It's headlined by Corey Sandhagen and TJ Dillashaw. If you didn't know, and if you didn't know, hey, give us a sub and maybe check out our second channel. It's 15-minute card breaks. Link down below in the description. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Fortunately for Kyler Phillips, who was originally supposed to be taking on Rafael Assunção, now he's ending up with Haulian Paiva out of Brazil. And this is a guy that it was kind of tough to get a read on him coming into the UFC. He beat Nascimento. Well, not Rodrigo that fought last weekend. Alan Nascimento on Contender Series. Lost a split decision to Kai Kara-France. Lost by finish to Rogério Bontorin, where his eyebrow just evaded him. It popped, and the doctor decided that the fight couldn't continue because it was a disgusting injury, and medically, probably not the best thing. So he knocks out Mark De La Rosa. He beats Yalgashu Magulov by decision, unanimous decision, after weighing in 129 pounds. And then if you go over to MMA decisions, 16 MMA media members had it for Zhumagulov, 29-28. Three had it 29-28 for Paiva. One had it, 30-27 for Paiva. Tim Burke from Bloody Elbow. Tim and I saw a different fight. I scored that one for Zhumagulov. You can find me on Twitter, at CraigAllenFNP. I'll stand on that hill till I die. It doesn't matter. Paiva gets the win. But miss weight, and he missed it by 3 pounds of that upper echelon limit. He was supposed to fight David Dvorak. He was hospitalized due to a botched weight cut. He said it himself to Guillerme Cruz and Damon Martin with MMA Fighting, and I'm going to read the quote for you. It was, I was cutting weight yesterday, and I was fine. I was really fine. I had remembered. And I remember leaving the sauna to do some towels, and then I had a strong headache and pain in the chest, and then I don't remember anything anymore. I only remember waking up in the hospital. He had low blood pressure, was dehydrated, and that's why he was passing out, wouldn't wake back up. That's bad.
That's not bad, right?
That's not good?
That's really bad. Like,
that's not normal?
No, we bring up how, like, torn ACLs are bad for fighters. Borderline, like, passing out a bunch of times and going to the hospital and being on death's doorstep is definitely bad for a fighter.
So now he moves up. He's up to 135. He's going to be on the level in terms of height. Little bit of a reach disadvantage for him against Kyler Phillips. His nickname's The Matrix. And since he didn't make it to the UFC, he lost on The Ultimate Fighter, then he comes out, he fights Victor Henry, loses a split decision. It was like, oh man, what's Kyler Phillips going to do? He wins with LFA, he wins in the UFC in a fight of the night against Gabriel Silva, he beats Cameron Else, wins a performance of the night, and then he beats Song Yadong his last time out in a back-and-forth contest. I love that fight, too.
I'll be honest. I thought Kyler Phillips was kind of like Zach LaVine for the longest time until he fought Song Yadong. I thought he was just like a big stat, no-win guy.
Matt's a big Zach LaVine hater.
Well, hey, win games and make the playoffs, and I'll think you're good at basketball. Anyways, but for Kyler Phillips, he was looking really good against sub-level powers of competition, and you kind of knew, okay, once this guy does fight those top 15 guys, he will be something special, but you didn't know. That was the problem. There were so many questions surrounding really the whole game of Kyler Phillips. He's this weird striker, but his background's wrestling. Like, what are we going to get? And his fight against Song Yadong, listen, I don't care how you scored it, it was a very close fight. It was either 2-1 for Kyler Phillips or 2-1 for Song Yadong. The point is that it was a very close and competitive fight, and it was a very entertaining fight where Kyler Phillips showed that he's more than just an entertaining striker against sub-level powers of competition. The fact that he not only was able to go in there and box with a guy like Song Yadong, but he was able to out-kickbox him and also mix in his own wrestling. The thing about Kyler Phillips is that just when you think he's going to be striking with you, just when you think, oh, this guy's going to shoot for takedowns, he's just good at mixing it up. Like, he's a weird fighter in the best way possible. He's not a guy who really gives his own reads a lot, and Dominic Cruz is always great for this. Like, his movement is so erratic that, like, almost he doesn't even know what he's going to do next, and that's why it's hard for his opponent to game plan. Kyler Phillips is similar in that aspect to where he will switch stances, he will throw kicks, he will wrestle. He's just always making his opponents think, and the fact that he's able to outthink his opponents in the top 15 makes me think that Kyler Phillips is really going to have a long and successful career in the UFC.
Phillips in this fight, again, going from Rafael Sansana, get it. Like, Rafael's not the same guy he was that was beating TJ Dillashaw.
Still a big name in his prime, though.
Still a big name, a big win. That's the one that kind of wins you over with a lot of people. And for Holly and Paiva, he's been there against some good fighters at 125 pounds. It's been a weird ride so far. He's ranked 12th at flyweight. And if you look at it for Kyler Phillips, he's ranked 14th, moved up a spot, staming down to 15 now. So for Phillips, he's moving and shaking. In the fight against Song Yadong, Yadong won the third round. Phillips won the first two. Maybe you could make an argument. I know a lot of people didn't, but still, you could. If you look at the odds for this one, I wasn't overly surprised. Phillips opened a minus 150 favorite. He's minus 260 right now. For Paiva, open a plus 130, he's plus 210. And if we have a look over on Tapology, yeah. 652 total votes, 92% for Phillips, and 72% have him to win by decision. Now, we're to the point of the card where we're up near the tippy top. We've been in agreement on every pick. We haven't picked a lot of underdogs. People don't like that, Matt. People don't love it. I went 10-2 2 weeks ago. We both went 8-2 last weekend, and we agreed on every single pick. So there also have been a lot of favorites winning. But we've had our shots on underdogs, too. I mean, we had Morozov as part of the question mark kicks parlay. He was an underdog.
Exactly. This is the problem. Do you know why Holly and Paiva is an underdog? Because he's fighting Kyler Phillips at 135 pounds. It's just, like, Kyler Phillips, to me, should be fighting, like, Dominic Cruz. Or, like, you know, a big name who might still be passed. Like,
Casey Kenney?
Yeah, even Casey Kenney. But just guys in the top 15.
They're teammates, though, I guess. MMA Lab connections.
There's a lot of good fighters out there, is my point. Like, even a Cody Garbrandt. Like, there's big names out there who could help Kyler Phillips get more to the forefront of UFC fans. Because Kyler Phillips has one of those styles where, even if he wasn't good on the mic, which he is, he does have that kind of added little extra factor. He's a very fan-friendly style of fighting. Maybe this is their, like, hey, Sean O'Malley, Chris Moutinho will try to get Kyler Phillips some kind of, like, posterization highlight, but it's just a really hard fight for Holly and Paiva. He might have a bit of a speed advantage just because he is the smaller guy. He is, if he can get on the inside of Kyler Phillips' range, he might be able to land some decent body shots working his way up to the head of Kyler Phillips, but other than those few isolated points, I don't think Holly and Paiva can have long-term success on the feet against a guy like Kyler Phillips. What's something I always say when it comes to takedown defense, Craig? What's the best way to defend a takedown? takedown. Don't let your opponent touch you in the first place. Kyler Phillips not only has great wrestling, he has great footwork too. So I just think this is a really hard matchup for Howley and Paiva.
So Howley and Paiva is a good striker. He's a good counter striker. Sometimes he waits too long. I will tell you this. If you want a method of victory for Howley and Paiva, sometimes Phillips leans and lurches in for some of his takedowns. Maybe Paiva, instead of just shoving everything down on top of Phillips, tries to throw an uppercut. We saw that last weekend in a couple of different exchanges, but maybe Paiva is able to catch him on the way in. You might see that, but for me, I like everything out of Phillips' game, where Paiva is a great striker. Sometimes in those takedowns, it's like, man, I have to work so hard to take or to negate this takedown attempt that he doesn't throw elbows in tight. He doesn't throw his own punches in tight. So I have a really hard time going with Paiva here. If you have a good option for him, you let us know down below in the comments section. But right now, both of us going Phillips. Right?
I think this fight should be really good. And listen, I don't think Paiva is just going to get blown out of the water. But again, Kyler Phillips seems to be one of those like Sean. And again, Sean O'Malley is kind of the cheap comparison because they both fight at 135. But again, I think Kyler Phillips is more in that kind of O'Malley rising star category than a guy like Howley Paiva.
Phoenix breeding winners at 135 pounds. You got Kyler Phillips. We both have him to get this win. Listen, big time fights at bantamweight. I'll pull out the props. You have Reese's Pieces. I ate some. So check out that video.
For and the once, doctor, Craig eats the prop.
The Dr. Pepper, Randy Costa taking on Adrian Yanez. Go back and check that one out if you did miss it. And then up at the top, Sandhagen is taking on one really tough out. And a guy who has the greatest walkout in all of MMA, TJ Dillashaw. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Co-main event coming up this weekend at women's bantamweight, and even in the main event, you have a men's bantamweight fight between Sandhagen and Dillashaw, if you didn't know already, but I had a lot of fun making the thumbnail for this one because we have two ranked contenders battling it out, and this division's weird because last weekend, Marion Renault, she retires. I didn't know she was going to retire, and then all of a sudden...
Okay, Craig, you didn't think a 44-year-old losing seven straight fights is going to retire? Well, you had to think a little bit.
Five in a row, but you have the return of Misha Tate. Misha was coy. She won a top five fighter. Maybe it's, who? Yana Kunitskaya, but she lost. So maybe it's Irene Aldana.
Holly
maybe
Holm.
It's one of the fighters here. Holly Holm, but does she have a fight booked? And then, I thought Jermaine Duran to me, but hey, maybe I'm crazy. She's the number one ranked contender. If you look at this division, Asmalad at three, and then Macy Chasson coming in at number nine. So it's interesting that way, right? Because Ladd's so far ahead in terms of the rankings, but they're so fluid that I just feel like it doesn't really matter that much.
Women's bantamweight rankings don't matter apart from the top three, because they're in a tier list of their own, and then there's everybody else. You have Amanda Nunes, Holly Holm, and Jermaine Duran. I mean, let's be honest. Amanda Nunes is head and shoulders above Jermaine Duran and Holly Holm. But then you have Jermaine Duran and Holly Holm, who have only proven that they can beat each other, and no one else has been able to beat them yet.
That's why we get our future title challenger, and man, oh man, if you didn't know that, this is UFC 266 coming up on the rankings. Your next title challenger in Juliana Pena is ranked fifth. She just moved up a spot without even winning a fight. So let's focus on this one because, Matt, for Macy Chasson, she had that one loss against Lena Landsberg back just almost 2 years ago. Since then, came back, beat Shannon Young, who came in on short notice, more of a 125er, beat Marion Renault her last time out. Man, she beat her bad in that fight. She beat her good. She beat her bad. She outstruck her.
Fight's a lot closer than you remember, though. She did get taken down by Marion Renault, and that's really what this fight's going to come down to. I don't think Aspen Ladd can strike with Macy Chasson whatsoever on the feet. I think if she did, she'll get stopped. The flip side is, Macy can't get taken down even once, because if she does, she's going to get ground and pounded like there's no tomorrow. Aspen Ladd is in a category of her own, where she is the Habib of this weight class. When she gets people down, she wastes zero time with her ground and pounding. Aspen Ladd is one of those fighters where her ground and pound is that hellacious, like, you hear the thud every single time she lands. Go back to the Yana Kunitskaya fight, and listen, I know Yana Kunitskaya, she might not be the hardest person to beat by knockout, that tends to be how she loses, but still, it wasn't like it was a flash KO, like she just caught her with one shot. She dominated her for not only minutes, but rounds, and then was able to get the finish. It was a really nice performance for Aspen Ladd, who is coming off a terrible loss in her career, and this is the really interesting thing about this fight, and this is why I'm so excited for it. Macy has yet to be a top fighter in this division. It's not her fault. Marion Renault is kind of getting on the way there, but she has yet to solidify herself as one of the top fighters in this division. I think it is her ceiling, but with a win over Ladd, it puts her in that, like, okay, you're close to the home Irene Aldana type category, and the same thing can be said for Ladd, honestly. Kunitskaya wins good, but not great. I would definitely think this is a better win for her if she is able to get it this
When week. I look at Macy Chasson's line, it's crazy to me that she was a fighter that was 2-0, fought Larissa Pacheco in 2018, who had already been in the UFC, and finished her. She beat Leah Letson, who All right, whatever. Beats Panty Kanzad to win the season. That ages like fine wine and not like milk. Beats Gina Mazzani, looks amazing. Beats Cupcake, not Misha Tate, Sarah Morris. Has that loss to Lena Landsberg? So let's go back. Hold on. UFC, The Ultimate Fighter, that's in the States. 235 is in Vegas. She fights Sarah Morris. That one's in Canada and Ontario. She gets that win. Fights Lena Landsberg over in Denmark. But it was a weird one because Copenhagen, Malmo, Sweden, where Lena Landsberg are from. If you had a strong arm and a baseball, maybe you could hit the other one. I don't know if the countries would like that. But again, Europe's different than Canada and the States, so I'll just leave that one where it is. But didn't look good in that fight against Lena Landsberg. Looked great on the short notice fight against Shannon Young. Fought Marion Renault earlier on this year. Now she gets to fight against Aspen Ladd. For Aspen Ladd, if we back it on up a little bit, she's been in the UFC for a really long time. Did you think at the start maybe the future was at 125 pounds more so?
It was kind of weird because I know we're going to go through her record in a sec, but there is a loss in her amateur career that always stands out to me. She has a loss to Cynthia Calvillo, and that's weird because Cynthia Calvillo, former strawweight, moved up to flyweight. It was weird because Aspen Ladd was always one of those fighters who seemed like she was flirting with 125, but then you do realize, like, when she's in there with other women at bantamweight, she is a lot bigger and a lot more physically strong than a lot of these women at bantamweight. The only weird fight for Aspen Ladd was that Sajara Eubanks fight, and it was way too close.
Which one?
The second one. The first one she was able to win, but the second one was close. You could tell that when Aspen Ladd isn't able to get the takedown offensively, she's a little bit awkward on her feet. Now, she can get into these, like, Cindy Dandois-esque striking combinations where they don't look good, don't get me wrong, but they will, oddly enough, kind of land. She can get herself into a clinch that way. Again, the big stat that I can't forget, though, is you bring up the Macy Chaisson fight against Marion Renault. It was closer than a lot of people like to admit. Like, Marion Renault was able to take Macy down, and that's a really big factor in that fight. Marion Renault, at 43 years of age, is not a great wrestler. She's a great jiu-jitsu fighter, but the wrestling has always been something that she has struggled with, and I really do think that if Marion Renault can go out there and get an offensive takedown against you, I really think Aspen Ladd only needs one takedown to accumulate enough damage to make you a lesser version of yourself later on in the fight. Again, this fight's one of those, like, water and oil. If it's on the feet, I heavily favor Macy. If it's on the mat, of course, I heavily favor Aspen Ladd. But that's why this one's so much fun.
For Aspen Ladd, her last fight out was against Yana Kunitskaya back in December of 2019. Finished her in that one. Before that, she lost in 16 seconds to Jermaine Duranemi. Was it an early stoppage? Was it a finish? I thought it was. But again, I thought that Amanda Lemos beat Montserrat Conejo. So what do I know? But when I look at this, she was supposed to fight Sarah McMahon just over a year ago. Tore her ACL and her MCL. So for Aspen Ladd, she's traveled all over to train to get ready for this one. I've seen her a lot in Colorado. She was always at Colorado. She's been in California. She's been at the PI. She's had Andrea Lee in her corner. I've also seen her train with, who was it? Miranda Maverick getting ready for this one. So a lot of different people to train with. A lot of strong bodies in the gym. Again, pull up the picture right here. It's Maverick, Lee, Aspen Ladd. She also has, who else? A couple of big names in Joy Pendle Falcons that you may have heard of in the past. So a lot of great people to train with coming into this one for Aspen Ladd. Matt, I look at the odds for this one. Ladd opened a minus 150 favorite. She opened a minus 200 favorite. She's minus 189 right now. For Macy Chaisson, opened a plus 170. She's plus 155 right now. Last part about Macy Chaisson, she splits time between gyms. She just earned her brown belt over at a gym that's not Fortis. It's Mid-City Martial Arts and Fitness. After 7 years of training, she got surprised by her coach.
Congrats.
Trains at Fortis MMA. We talked about it with Emily Ducati, but also Saif Saud, the head coach. Cheyenne Bays, whatever you think about her. Jinyu Frey, among others. There's also Helen Peralta. So there's a lot of big names there as well. But when I look at it, I agree with you. It definitely is oil versus water, grappling versus striking. Macy Chaisson in the UFC, in terms of her overall body work, 64% takedown defense. The strike line's great. 4.16 significant strikes landed per minute to 2.17 taken. Did I slur it a little? Yeah, because I'm talking really fast. But when I look at this one, over on Tapology, 741 total votes, 83% Ladd, 75% by decision. For the 17% that I have Macy Chaisson to win, 71% by decision. Matt, we teased this early on. I think we're split on the pick. What are you thinking?
I really do see this going either way. Now, I know I'm normally the ACL guy, and I throw up a lot of warnings when people tear their ACLs and whatnot, because here's the thing, and it is honest. Like, in MMA, people don't think that ligament damage is a big deal like they do in other sports, and it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it's honestly, it's like, weird. This just, it is weird. Like, people are just like, oh, they tore their ACL. I'm sure they'll be back the same version of themselves. I know people who watch
it. What about ACL and MCL?
Not great. Like, Klay Thompson is one of the best three-point shooters ever, a perennial all-star. One of the great players in the NBA, tore his ACL and Achilles, and people don't know if he's ever going to be the same again. Like, in other sports, people put a lot of stock into that stuff, and they probably should. But again, with this fight being so yin and yang, I really do think Lat only needs that one takedown, and I think if she can only use her left knee, let's say, I still think she will be able to get that one takedown. For Macy, it's going to be keep her away. Use your footwork as your takedown defense, because if Macy gets herself backed up against the cage, she can get a little awkward because she is so lanky for this division of getting her own back off of the cage. If Aspen Ladd does get her up there, I do see her trying to make this fight boring, trying to get her down against the cage. And again, if Aspen Ladd does only get that one takedown, I think she's going to do enough with it to ultimately get the win.
I've seen a lot of Aspen Ladd on Instagram, walking around in the mountains, hanging out with her dogs. That's good to see.
And just one last thing for me, and it's a point that you brought up with Thiago Santos. The reason that we were so hard on Santos after he tore his ACL was, do you know how much footage we saw of him moving?
There was one video where he was doing capoeira in the grass, and then they, like, inverted it and put it out there again.
So the good thing is, at least from what I've seen out of Aspen Ladd, she is still active, and there still is new training footage out there. That is always one thing that's always stayed in the back of my mind, so I thought I'd give you flowers for that. But it is actually nice to see Aspen Ladd moving around post-surgery, and we're not just getting, like, old highlights, and that's it.
And it's been quite a while, but I like Macy Chasson for the counter-striking, for the movement on the feet, as long as she's nimble and quick, she should be able to get the win in this one. Again, much more polished striker, much bigger fighter too in terms of height, reach, and just overall size. Macy Chasson brings it with the best of them. I like her in this one. Not normally would I take somebody that's that low to beat somebody that high, but I do like Fortis MMA's Macy Chasson in this fight, and you've got Ladd.
I think this could be a surprisingly good co-main event, to be completely honest.
I'm going with the underdog Macy Chasson in this one. Matt's got Aspen Ladd, the first pick that we're split on. It took us to the co-main event, Matt. We have a big-time main event. And if you're excited about it, I'm excited about it. Matt is too. This is must-see TV. Corey Sandhagen taking on the man himself, that little snake in the grass, TJ Dillashaw. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
From the guys who brought you Fight Night Picks, and for a short time, hitting above the Mendoza line, comes the Allen Brothers' next project. Let's tear the cover off and join in 15-Minute Card Breaks.
And welcome back to another episode of 15-Minute Card Breaks. But wait, this is Fight Night Picks. And if you didn't know, we have a second channel that we just started up in the last number of weeks. It's called 15-Minute Card Breaks. And if you're a sports card fan like we are, then you're going to want to check out that channel there. You can find us on the socials at 15-Minute Card Breaks. Instagram, Twitter, hell, we're even on TikTok, Matt. And it really got us back. Well, it was the Panini Prism box open that we did here with Fight Night Picks. We figured, hey, let's branch off. We had a lot of cards already. And in the past few weeks, we opened some more Panini Prism. We opened the 2021 Donruss. And listen, that was a lot of fun. That was a Tmall Asia Hobby Box exclusive. We ended up with a great card there. Some Pete Rose, Charlie Hustle. You knew what you were going to get there, but it was exciting nonetheless. Matt, we also had a really big break with the Hit Parade full-size batting helmet. Ooh. This one was 15 out of 100. We ended up with a really big... Well, Matt, let me show the people. I mean, it's inside of there. It even came with its own bag. It was a great find. And Matt, it's been a lot of fun over there on that channel.
It really has been. It just kind of gives us a chance to branch out and talk about something other than MMA. Because if you've been following Fight Night Picks, you know that we love to reference other sports when we talk about MMA. So this finally gives us a chance to dive a little bit deeper into all those other sports and try to show off maybe a little bit of our other sports knowledge while we're at it.
But I absolutely love it. And if you like that type of content, you can find us 15-Minute Card Breaks, link down below in the description. All sorts of fun there, and a sub over on that channel would really go a long way, and I can't wait for more content. So make sure you check out 15-Minute Card Breaks, and as we always say, let's tear the cover off. Absolutely insane main event coming up this weekend at the tippity top of the bantamweight rankings. Well, one guy's ranked up there. We have Corey Sandhagen, ranked second, taking on the former two-time bantamweight champ, TJ Dillashaw, that little snake in the grass. And for the little snake in the grass, or Fat Tyler, or whatever you want to call him, he used to call himself that, I'm not just making fun of him. It was announced in 2019, Matt, that he tested positive for some pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, not just serious stuff. He tested positive for EPO, and a lot of people know what EPO is. It was made very famous by, of course, Lance Armstrong in the Tour de France. EPO raises your red blood cell count, so it basically helps your cardio, because it allows more oxygen to get introduced into your bloodstream. Now, you might think, oh, for MMA, more like traditional anabolics might be helpful. But getting a huge advantage in cardio is a massive advantage, and EPO is one of those, like, really serious drugs. And that was the other thing about TJ Dillashaw. I'm just going to go off for a minute, if that's okay, because I really feel like the UFC isn't promoting this fight correctly at all. A lot of the headlines and a lot of the videos around this weekend's main event don't even mention Corey Sandhagen. It's just Dillashaw. This is the return. Oh, I'm going to come back. We're kind of refusing to talk about why he left in the first place, but it is really important. He failed a drug test for EPO against Henry Cejudo. And this is the thing. He not only failed the drug test, he lied about it afterwards. And that's the other thing that is important. You not only cheated, you lied about it on the Joe Rogan podcast in front of millions of people. And listen, I'm not a fan of that podcast myself, but the fact that someone who claims, oh, I'm a lifelong martial artist, this is about discipline. You see, him and Dwayne Ludwig are basically brothers, not just trainer and son. And yeah, I might sound emotional, but the fact that you lost a fight, you blamed it all on Kevin McDonald, who did his job, and then you cry, oh, he took away the opportunity. I did everything right, and he cheated. No, you're the one who cheated. Just accept it. This is the thing. Vieira had to be put down, sat down, and say, hey, you lost. It doesn't matter who you were yesterday. You can be better tomorrow. TJ Dillashaw hasn't admitted the fact that he was even wrong yesterday.
No, he has. And it's been in painstaking detail on the UFC's behalf that now there's a whole video you can find out there on Fight Pass. They're making you feel bad that he's gone away. And
you should.
Listen, let's peel back the curtain a little bit. Let's break the fourth wall. Craig Allen, fight fan. Craig Allen, pre-2018 when Fight Night Picks started. It's right there. Established 2018.
Still champion, TJ Dillashaw.
It was a podcast when I was talking to the computer. My favorite fighter, one of them was TJ Dillashaw. Did I know that he was taking EPO? No. But I'm going to read you right off of the USADA's website, ufc.usada.org. TJ Dillashaw accepts sanction for violation of UFC anti-doping policy. Dillashaw, 33, tested positive for recombinant human erythropoietin RHU EPO as a result of an in-competition urine sample he provided on January 18, 2019. Then the comment was all around, well, if it's just this fight, how far back does it go? Are they going to test how far back? It was just kind of like, all right, see you later. Nothing ever happened. He loses that fight. More importantly, that was his move down to flyweight. He was already the bantamweight champ at that point. He had beaten poor old Cody Garbrandt twice. They were wild fights. Both guys got rocked. Dillashaw came out on the winning end of both of them. But when you look at it, he didn't look very good against Cejudo, and even in the build-up to that fight, I know that was my narrative. Listen, you look on the old Instagrams, Dillashaw looks great coming into this fight. He really does. He looks bodied up coming into this one, and if he wins this fight, he can really put to rest all of the EPO talk, or at least some of it, at least some of it. But when he was moving down to 124, man, it ended up being 124, 124.5, as I have in front of me, 124.6. Physically, he looks sickly.
He really did, and that's another big thing that we have to talk about. TJ Dillashaw is 35 years old, competing in the bantamweight division, a division dominated by speed.
2-year USADA suspension.
Exactly, and again, I'm going to bring up the Chael Sonnen quote, you don't get better at something by not doing it, and this is the problem with TJ Dillashaw. The one knock that he ever had against him skill set-wise was his durability. Like, TJ Dillashaw, as a skill set, take your personal opinion away from it. Well, he's almost a 10 out of 10 in offensive wrestling. He never gets taken down. He never gets tired. And his Muay Thai is super unique, and he's got crazy power for the division. That was him at his peak, though. I always go back to what Bas Rutten said about Alistair Overeem. Bas Rutten. Just let me finish my point. To what Bas Rutten said when Alistair Overeem had failed for steroids. He said it wasn't about Alistair Overeem needing to be better. It was an emotional crutch. He needed the steroids. It's like, okay, these are going to make me better, so I feel confident enough to at least get in there. I'm not saying Dillashaw had that problem or he was on steroids his whole career, but when you do something, and it is a weak thing to do a drug that you're going to get suspended for, but when you do a weak thing like that, it means you're looking for a way out. And now you're 35 years old, all of a sudden coming back against one of the most dangerous finishers in the division. I know Misha Tate was able to sort of turn back the clock, but you have to understand, Misha Misha Tate was fighting against a 44-year-old at the time. Someone who was on a massive losing streak who, let's just be honest, and I like Marion Renault, she was well past her prime in that fight. You're now asking a 35-year-old TJ Dillashaw, who isn't getting a warm-up fight, who is now expected to take this fight after he was through, like, a life-changing weight cut. It's just, there's a lot of wrinkles around this for TJ Dillashaw that I don't personally love.
So Dillashaw, the weird thing with him, coming out of the training lab, and you look at them, I remember even some certain Syed Awad fights where they'd show him in the Bellator backstage, and he's got, what, like, different things popped on his chest. Like, they're testing every vital. They're maximizing everybody's peak performance. So for Dillashaw, still there.
They did it all right.
Forget about everything, but still there. Looks absolutely bodied up. And I considered for the longest time, and I still, again, you're talking some of the best wrestlers in MMA. Dillashaw was my number one, and I get it. Did he get taken down? Hardly ever. 86% takedown defense, 37% on the offensive, goes for 1.68 takedowns per 15 minutes. But usually you only need one, maybe two, and then you're ending up on top. You're ending up getting a win and riding it out and floating throughout your fights. Dillashaw with his striking, too. Huge positive differential. 5.37 landed per minute to 3.03 received at a 65% defensive. That's even better than Sandhagen, who's at a 59% defensive clip. Rides a little bit higher in terms of his accuracy, but the number in terms of damage definitely favors Dillashaw. So coming back, you're taking on the second-ranked guy in Corey Sandhagen. And listen, for Corey Sandhagen, this is a guy that has gone through some adversity in the UFC, and I know it's been way more wins than losses. The one loss to Aljamain Sterling, where they're dry early on. Sterling sinks up that great rear naked choke. Throw out your thoughts of Sterling's win over Petr Yan out the window. The guy's an amazing fighter. But look at how he's come back. And I even look, he beats Austin Arnett. All right, it's a fun fight. He beats Yuri Alcantara and finishes him on the ground. That's impressive.
Faced adversity too, which is important.
He gets rocked by Mario Bautista in their fight, and he finishes him. Beats Lineker by split and ate great just about fight. Every shot he could. Beats Sun Tzu. And then those last two wins, he finishes Marlon Moraes in a disgusting manner. But you want to talk disgusting. Poor Frankie Edgar.
Disgusting, nice. But also beautiful? Like, yeah. That's the crazy thing. Like, Corey Sandhagen is a surgeon when he's in there. Everything he does is extremely precise. And you can say the same thing about TJ Dillashaw. There is one component of TJ Dillashaw's game, though, that I think is going to get him caught in this fight. One thing Dillashaw does really well is he ducks a lot. He really does. He shifts his weight left to right a lot. And he likes to have that one left hand really high, kind of judging the distance, and then he uses the duck. What's Corey Sandhagen known for? Like, him and Dan Hooker probably have the best two in the UFC. It's his knees right up the middle. I actually think the striking style of TJ Dillashaw might leave him susceptible to that knee of Corey Sandhagen. And again, even if you think TJ Dillashaw might be the slightly more well-rounded fighter in this, he doesn't have durability on his side. I've seen Corey Sandhagen eat bombs from the likes of, like, John Lineker. And yeah, he might wobble backwards, but still, he is as durable as fighters come. TJ Dillashaw's been wobbled by John Dodson, knocked him out. Garbrandt dropped him. He got knocked out by Henry Cejudo, who's not really a power puncher. I understand you. It was a bad weight cut, and there was a lot of weird circumstances around that fight. It's just, it's hard for me to say that TJ Dillashaw is going to be a better version than the last time I saw him, and I guess I just can't say the last version of him is going to beat Corey Sandhagen.
I'm going to say something that might seem crazy for me to say, but I'm dead serious when I say it. I want to hear what Brendan Schaub has to say about this fight. And you know why? It's because he's been the highest on Corey Sandhagen for the longest time. They're both from Aurora. If you go over to Dillashaw's Instagram page, his last post is with Brendan Schaub on Food Truck Diaries. So I would like to hear Brendan's take on that. Again, kind of wild
probably
to say it.
Probably a bad one.
Kind of wild to say it, but I am actually eager to hear what he has to say, because he does have quite a bit of knowledge specifically on these two fighters. Specifically on these two fighters. But when I look at this one, for Dillashaw, he trains with some great fighters. I mentioned Awad, who's kind of moved away from the training lab, but Juan Archuleta, the bantamweight champ, over with Bellator, man, this guy has just continued to get better, and he's a great guy to train with to get ready for Sandhagen. Likewise, for Sandhagen, I've seen pictures where he's been training with Rufus Sport guys. Now, some at Rufus Sport, Sergio Pettis, a great guy to get ready for a fight like this, wasn't able to get it done against Archuleta, but still, fast, speedy guy that can move in and out and strike quite well. Another one of those pictures over there, I think it's Ryan Hall. So Hall, definitely a good guy to train with.
Stott.
Gaethje, Rafa Garcia, but the perfect one is, yes, Ralphian Stotts. And Matt, for Ralphian Stotts, I really think the UFC missed the boat on signing him. Like, they effed up big time. You want to see a great fight of his where he just dominates in the wrestling? It's when he fought Keith Lee.
Dominated every aspect of that fight.
He's put on a good performance since then. Ralphian Stotts, I think, is, like, championship material. perfect guy for Corey Sandhagen to have to get ready for this fight. So for Sandhagen, it's guy after guy after guy. For Dillashaw, his main guy, he's always in the corner of Archuleta. There are other good fighters at the gym. Obviously, he has Bang Ludwig to coach him, and they've been together for the longest time. They've worked together. I like everything I've seen out of Dillashaw. I like what I've seen out of Sandhagen in training for both these guys. Matt, in terms of the odds, Sandhagen, a pretty decent favorite. Open minus 164, now minus 179. For Dillashaw, open to plus 136. He's a plus 149. Over on Tapology, 679 total votes. 80% Sandhagen to 20% Dillashaw. Matt, are you surprised by any of that? And listen, I'm not going to offer any pushback. I think the right thing to do for us would be to head on over to Fight Night Picks over in the community tab, because we threw it out there and we have more votes than Tapology. I put it out there. Big time Bantamweight main event on the way next weekend. Now this weekend. Who's getting the win? 74% Sandhagen, 26% Dillashaw. Out of the comments, Toniel Darigouche. Sandhagen by knee KO. TJ going to shoot for a very telegraphed takedown. Get knee in the chin. Matt, you're in agreement. We've got Serple Aiden saying, people forget that Dillashaw is an NCAA wrestler, so he always has the option to take the fight to the ground if he feels uncomfortable striking. Sandhagen's takedown defense and ground game is very suspect. I disagree. Angelo Kaz saying Sandhagen times TJ as he's going for a takedown, gets a KO in the second round. Matt, I'll throw one more out there. Let's go with Philip Casey A. Calloway saying, I don't think Sandhagen has enough ground defense for TJ's wrestling. We'll see if he can pull it off without the PEDs and take 2 years off, though. Go TJ. So what are you saying?
So Corey Sandhagen can dig underhooks anytime TJ goes for a takedown. The fact that he's so much taller than him is actually going to be a big advantage for Sandhagen. Because if I have underhooks on someone like Craig, and Craig is a couple inches shorter than me, you can just get him. Like, his weight is messed up because his weight is constantly... he's going to be in an uncomfortable position the whole entire time. Height does help you when you defend takedown attempts. It helps you in the clinch, too. I know it might hurt him, too, if Dillashaw actually can get in on his legs. But as long as Sandhagen can dig those underhooks, I actually think it's going to help him a lot in the takedown defense aspect of this game, of this fight, sorry. And for Dillashaw, I think we are going to see him lose a bit of a step. You can't have a weight cut that's straight up, like, he changed his whole life around that weight cut. Now, I understand it was a long time ago, but that is a life-altering type of cut that he had to put himself through. Like, you remember those pictures where it was him, like, with the sauna suit on and just pills all over the table because he just had to supplement all of his vitamins and everything because he couldn't have actual food for almost months out before that fight. I really do think a weight cut like that has lasting effects on you for the rest of your life, and I really don't think this is a great fight for TJ to have his first UFC fight back in on. I know I claim that the UFC is a lot more like boxing than we like to realize when they put together fights like Moutinho versus Sean O'Malley, when you kind of know who's going to win going into it. This is the complete opposite. I actually see the UFC trying to capitalize off TJ Dillashaw's name right now. Corey Sandhagen is the only loss in the UFC is to the current champion, and it would be a perfect fight if you could have a Corey Sandhagen versus like a Piotr Jan for a number one contendership. Like, that is a fight that is not only exciting for every fan in the world, but would absolutely deliver. All that being said, I do think Corey Sandhagen is going to go out there and show why he is the future of this division.
I think a fight against Dominic Cruz or Pedro Munhoz would have made a lot more sense. Not 300%. Even Frank Yeager. That one wouldn't make sense. Moraes on a long...
Munhoz is a good call.
Like, the Edgar, Moraes, and Garbrandt, those don't make sense to me. Maybe a Jose Aldo. But the weird thing is, after Dillashaw went away, it was, well, I'm coming back into a title shot. And now he doesn't get it. He gets Corey Sandhagen. You're close. The other thing is, these guys were supposed to fight a couple of months ago. There was a cut to the eyebrow of TJ Dillashaw that kind of put him out. You got to glue it together or stitch it up. And now we finally get this fight. But for me, I have to go against my better judgment in picking Dillashaw and go with Corey Sandhagen in this fight. I think he has too many weapons from long range. He throws wonky, weird attacks. He moves so odd in the cage that, hey, maybe some of those moves, he's not the fleetest of foot, so Dillashaw can catch him, drag him down into those deep waters, but I think eventually Sandhagen's going to win out. You don't get to 35 2 years away getting a lot better. I know it sounds strange because Tate was able to do it last weekend, and maybe Dillashaw can, but you let us know down below in the comment section who you have. I've got Corey Sandhagen here.
Marin Renault. Sorry, I just got to stay on the camera. Corey Sandhagen. Like, these are the fighters who they're coming back in their return fights. And it really does matter. Like, Sandhagen knocked out one of the best Muay Thai fighters in the UFC in Marlon Moraes. I understand he's a little chinny, but just as an offensive fighter, he's one of the better ones out there. And what he did to Frank Yeager was disgusting. I understand Frank Yeager's not in his prime anymore, but just the way that... Again, that's one of those knockouts where he set it up, even though it only happened in 20 seconds. He used his movement to set up the movement of Frank Yeager and basically walked him directly into a flying knee. Like, people don't realize that just because the stuff Sandhagen does is weird, He also has high fight IQ to go along with that obscurity. I do like Sandhagen in this fight. And personally, I think if we did get a Piotr Jan versus Sandhagen fight for a number one contendership, that has fight of the year written all over it.
Matt, both of us going with Corey Sandhagen, Colorado's own. I gave Brendan Schaub shouts.
Who are we?
Wow. Matt, we had a great weekend. Last weekend, both of us going 8-2. The question mark kicks parlay hit. So make sure you check us out this Saturday, 2 hours before the prelims on Friday. That normally goes out there, so you can subscribe. You can hit the old notification bell to know when we do go live. We run a few ads at the start. You got to support the channel. Make sure you check out our sponsor, Manscaped, as well as Vertiball. They're doing some darn things representing Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. And the other thing, Matt, if you haven't checked it out, Fight Night Picks, we made the move. 15-minute card breaks. It's our new channel. We're opening boxes. We hit up the old Panini Prism. We also opened a signed batting helmet, and this thing is legit. It was a mystery box from Hit Parade. All sorts of great stuff out there. If you're a fan of maybe some other sports, or if you're just a sports card fan, 15-minute card breaks, you can find it down below in the description. I'm really looking forward to this weekend. If there's ever any changes, any fights fall out, any are added, we update as soon as we can with as most information as we can get. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it.